Good evening and welcome. This is the October 15, 2013 Glen Ellyn Board of Education meeting held here at the Central Services Office. The time is 6 p.m. I call the meeting to order. Mr. Ellis, would you please lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Absolutely. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mrs. Stecker, roll call, please.
Mr. Escalante.
Here.
Mr. Kenwood. Mr. Elder. Mr. Pachinski.
Here.
Mrs. Nelson. Here. Mr. Ellis.
Here.
Here. Adjourn to closed session. The board has determined it has a need to adjourn to closed session to discuss collective negotiating matters between the district and its employees or their representatives, or deliberations concerning salary schedules for one or more classes of employees, and also the placement of individual students in special education programs and other matters relating to individual students. May I have a motion to adjourn to closed session?
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Mrs. Nelson, second by Mr. Ellis. Roll call, please.
Mr. Escalante?
Yes.
Mr. Pachinski?
Yes.
Mrs. Nelson?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Black?
Yes. Okay, returning to open session. The time is 6:30. Moving on to presentation reports and initiatives. We have two reports tonight, one from William Blair and Company, and the second from MB Financial Bank.
Perfect. For tonight, our purpose tonight is to create a deeper understanding of the financial implications and the ability to looking at a certificate bond or other type of bonding ability that the district has to pay for a portion of the facilities. With that, we brought out two credible institutions to present to the board and to the community around their thinking. What we're also hoping is that the board is able to ask both institutions a number of questions that will satisfy their understanding of this financial decision that they'll be making in the coming weeks. With that, I'll hand it over to Bob to do the introductions.
So first up this evening, we have Elizabeth Hennessy, with a principal with William Blair. And Liz, why don't you come on up and begin your presentation. Thank you.
Bob, is our construction manager here?
They will be here. They're all coming here.
And we'll do introductions.
Just to introduce myself, my name is Elizabeth Hennessy, and I'm with William Blair & Company, and we've worked with the district since 2003-2004 on this updating plan. We worked with you on some of the referendum options over the years that we looked at, and we are a partnership downtown with over 1,100 people in Chicago. So we're based here in Chicago. My presentation tonight is to give you an idea of what type of debt you can issue, and let's start with the market update. So,
Liz, can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Is the handout you gave tonight the same as the one that we had earlier?
It is.
It's
it
hard
is.
To
no, that's okay.
There's still some trees for you.
All right, so page one looks at the historical municipal market data interest rates really over the last 5 years. And we have the blue line, which is the 20-year AAA MNB, and the green line is the 10-year. And if you look at our recent history from the end of May through mid-August, we really had rates increase, and that was due to the Federal Reserve's announcement that they were going to cut back on their quantitative easing. Rates went up very dramatically. When they decided in mid-September not to cut back on that quantitative easing, rates came back down a little bit, but not as low as they were back this spring in April. Page two looks at the AAA municipal yield curve, and this looks at interest rates from years 1 through 30, and the green line is where we are now. So what this tells us, comparing, you know, over the last 7 years, the short-term interest rates are still very low, but the yield curve is a bit steep. When you get out past 10 years, you can see that the interest rates really start to increase. Now, the district has two outstanding bond issues. The 2004 bond issues refunded the callable part of the 1998 referendum approved bonds for savings. We helped him with that issue. And then the outstanding 1998 bonds are the remaining capital appreciation portion of the issue. And as you can see, your debt is fairly short and will be maturing in total by the end of 2018. The next page just gives you an idea of what the semi-annual and annual payments are. And as you can see, the debt is pretty level with payments of about $2.8 million, going slightly up in 17 and 18 to $2.93 million. So very stable debt, just 5 years till you're totally debt-free. All right. Now, I'm going to talk tonight about non-referendum financing options. And these options have to do with issuing bonds that are paid out of the district's operating fund revenues. So these bonds do not have any additional tax levy or increase associated with them. Okay? So the first type of bonds is alternate bonds. These bonds are secured by two sources of revenue. The first is whatever type of revenue you pledge in your operating funds. Whenever you're looking at doing debt paid back from your operating funds, you need to think about, how am I going to budget for this going forward? Where am I going to make room in my budget to absorb this additional cost, and am I going to be able to sustain that for 5, 10, or 15, or 20 years at a maximum? So the first source of revenue is those pledged funds from operating funds. The second source of alternate bonds is a property tax levy for the debt service fund, which goes onto the tax rolls at the time you close this bond issue. Then each year, as you come up with your operating fund revenues through your budgetary process, that tax levy is abated. So it never hits the taxpayers. These bonds, because they have that tax levy associated with them, are viewed extremely securely and positively by the investing public, but they do have a couple authorization requirements, specifically a petition period and a public hearing. Now these alternate bonds also are not subject to the debt limit, and you don't have any debt limit problem. You have plenty of authority with regard to your debt limit, so it's not really an issue for you. So that's the first type of bonds. The second type are debt certificates, and debt certificates are much simpler. They only require the approval of a debt certificate resolution by the Board of Education. A debt certificate is, in fact, has underlying installment purchase contract or a lease agreement, similar to when you do leasing for technology, those kind of things. That's the type of contract that underlies a debt certificate. And then the reason they're called debt certificates is because you can sell it to multiple investors. It's made into certificates. So these are also paid from the general operating funds of the district. So you have to, again, do that budget exercise and you make sure you have room in your annual budget. The good news here, though, is that you can be somewhat flexible about that. In the alternate bonds, you pledge sources of revenue, and that's it for the life of the bond. With debt certificates, it's general fund pledge. So you can use general state aid, corporate personal property replacement taxes, operation and maintenance fund tax levy, that's one of the very typical, or education fund tax levy. You can use that for capital projects too, a portion of that. So anyway, the good news is you have flexibility to decide where you have budgetary room. Some investors feel more comfortable with the GO backing of alternate bonds. However, for a highly rated district like yourself, there would be very little interest rate difference between the debt certificates and the alternate bonds. You've got a Moody's rating, AA2, and Moody's does not distinguish its rating between either alternate bonds or debt certificates, so it should be the same rating. Maximum maturity is 20 years, and debt certificates are subject to the 6.9% debt limit. Okay, so the first set of options, we look at issuing $10 million in debt certificate proceeds and repaying them over 10, 15, and 20 years. So we recommend that you structure your repayment schedule with level debt service. Okay, so I think that's it helps you with your annual budgeting. You don't have some escalating payment you have to continually make more room in your budget for. It's just a simple, conservative way to budget. So the 10 years gives you an average annual payment of $1.1 million, total debt service of 11.6, and an all-in true interest cost at 2.96%. And that's conservative rates as of a week ago. Okay, and then the 15-year amortization has annual payments of $875. Total debt service, the longer you go out, the more interest you're going to pay. So in this case, $15.1 million. And then the all-in true interest cost is $369. And then the 20-year payback gives you an annual cost of $748,000 a year and total debt cost of $14.9 or 4.26%. The next page shows $5 million for 10 and 15 years, and then $7 million for 10 and 15 years. So, you know, I know you're kind of trying to decide the scope of your projects and how much you're going to finance, so that's why we've got kind of these additional options. So the $5 million, if you did pay that back in 10 years, gives you about a $582,000 payment. 15 years is about $437,000. For $7 million, $815,000 annual payment, and for 15 years, $612,000. And then we said, what do you feel like you can afford maybe a year, and if we just back into it? So Bob and Paul kind of came up with, well, what can we get for $700,000 not going out any further than 15 years? So if we look at today's interest rate, that's a 3.69, that gets you about $8,020,000. So, just the advantages of debt certificates. Again, no referendum required, no petition period or public hearing. You have the ability to pay for capital projects over time versus upfront. So, as you look at your basket of capital projects, you can think about, gosh, do I want to pay in cash? How much debt do I want to issue, and how much can I afford on an annual basis? And then the question about how long you want to go out, you need to think about, well, when is the next time you need to do a capital project like this? In 10 years or 15 years, and we can help you plan for that, and amortization is this issue. The disadvantage is that you do have to make room in your operating funds for the debt service payment, and debt certificates typically have a higher interest rate, but as I mentioned, given your strong Moody's rating, I don't think that would affect you. So, I am open to questions.
So, so can you explain to me these all-in-true interest costs? What makes that up?
We use the municipal market weighted yield scale for AAAs that are then spread for AA2. And the bonds that you're considering issuing, the ones that are $10 million and under, the good news is that you get an extra deduction on the interest rate for those for bank qualifications. Assuming you don't issue any more than $10 million in a calendar year, you can sell these bonds to banks, who will give you that extra deduction for bank qualification in the form of lower interest rates. And for years 1 through 7 right now. That's worth about 0.05% or 5 basis points. For year 7 through 10, about 10 basis points. So it can be a significant savings on the interest rate. So we use those bank-qualified interest rates. And then the all-in-true interest cost refers to any placement fees, underwriting fees, bond counsel, disclosure counsel, rating. All those fees are wrapped up into each of these bond issues to give you a realistic idea of what your all-in-true interest cost is.
Big deal. So, what's the true rate of that bond that you're getting? Or what is it? Is it Treasuries plus 25th on you?
It's because we're tax exempt. It's the municipal market data, AAA MMD scale, and then we add a spread to that based on where they qualify the paper that's rated AA is trading. So you're probably looking at the municipal market data plus 50 to be conservative. We like to be conservative, 50 basis points.
So the 10 bips discount is for terms that are 7 to 10 years? Is that what you said, or is that back then?
Yeah, the discount you're getting for bank qualified varies by year.
Okay. So when it varies by year of the term, so the first year is different than the second.
Right, and what I'm saying is like the first 5 to 7 basis points we're finding is worth, or the first 5 to 7 years result in a savings of about 0.05%.
Gotcha.
If you get out a little longer, it's 10%, and if you get out really long, out into the 15 to 20 year, there's a very significant saving that's closer to 20, 25 basis points.
Yeah, basically, it's not percent.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
Fits off the
interest rate. Yeah.
Fits off the interest rate.
All right, but did you also say there was a break in the $10 million number? Did you say that the interest rate, there's a break? If we borrow $10 million and above?
$10 million or below. That's where you get the bank qualified.
Okay.
And it's got to be within any calendar year.
And the example,
so let's say, I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
So let's say you want to borrow $12 million. Let's say, your project's come up to $12 million. That's what you want to borrow. What we would suggest to you, if it works for the timing in your project, is to do a bank-qualified piece in December and another bank-qualified piece in January, so you can get that discount on both pieces of the issue.
And are those savings reflected in your 5 and 7 and page 8?
All these options are bank-qualified rates, conservatively.
You answered one of my questions, which was how does the district's bond rating affect or impact, and so what I've heard you say is that because we have a Moody's rating and where it's at, we're getting potentially a better deal.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
If for the all-in-true cost, to pick up on what Patrick and Joe were talking about, subject to change, how do we...
Oh, yeah. I mean, these rates are just one
right.
snapshot in time, and
right.
we're in a little bit of a volatile market
yeah.
right now.
Yeah.
We'll see how they change. You know, the trend, of course, is for rates to go up. But every time our economy trips or we have some bad news, that's actually good for the bond market rate.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a fixed rate over the life.
It's a fixed rate. It's
right.
not variable. Correct.
Once we lock it in.
Yes.
And what is your... I have two questions that tie together. So in your assumptions here and what the examples you provided, these are funding as of when? I see the payment.
Last week,
yeah.
I remember when I sent this to you, Bob.
So Thursday, Wednesday?
Yeah, last Thursday.
So the examples you gave us, we fund on that day, and then we have these payment streams starting at 6:30 or 15 is when the first payment is due in your examples. Now, what is the, is there forward locks available? Because our funding is not out for some time. So how
there
would you handle that
situation? There are forward locks available. Forward rates. I think you have to be careful about the cost on those.
Sure.
Typically, we see those costing about 5 basis points a month.
A month?
A month.
A month.
So wow. that can add up.
That's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I have two questions. Question number one is, what is the relative cost in terms of the bond council and the different pieces of the expenses?
you know, just for estimation purposes.
Yeah, that's fine. Just give me back, back
about
the
1.5% of the par amount you issue.
That's what I'm saying.
About 1.5% of the par amount that you issue.
Okay.
And that would be for a negotiated underwriting with a bond rating and a full offering. That kind of, your question kind of brings up another thing for consideration. I know you're not really ready to go to market yet, but there's really three ways you can go to market. You can use an underwriter in a negotiated sale, which is what I've priced in here. You can use, and I'm talking about what my role could be, three things for you. Could be the underwriter, that's what we were in 2004, that's what we are for most of our districts. We could act as a placement agent and then forego the cost of issuance associated with the bond rating, disclosure counsel, preparing an official statement, so those costs would be reduced, and look at placing your issue with a local bank. And we've done that very successfully for other districts. It just depends if you're going with a 10-year or a 20-year. If you're going for a 20-year, I don't know if the banks would be so interested. Kathy can tell you that. But certainly for the 10 to 15-year, I think we see banks very active, depending on how much you can issue. And then the third way would be for me to act as independent financial advisor and conduct a competitive bond sale where you have other broker-dealers bidding on the bonds on a set date through a formal bid process. So those are really the three methods of selling bonds, which have a whole different fees associated with each.
And then would the rates be similar in terms of, or does one of them have a benefit, a cost benefit better than the others, or are they similar?
There, you know, for given your credit, I think that you would find that the rate, the interest rate that you pay would be similar. What's going to be different is the cost of issuance.
Which is rolled into the
lot.
And one other quick question. You had the you had the benefits of the death certificates listed.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see a chart that it was the ultimate bond.
You know, and I didn't really follow up on that because given your strong rating, I don't see a very big interest rate differential between the alternate bonds or the debt certificates. The biggest advantage would be an interest rate advantage with the double barrel bonds. If you were a single A rated district or less, that would be more of a factor for you. But being a strong double A rated district, we don't see a lot of difference between the debt certificates and the alternate bonds. And it has to do with that double-barreled factor in the ultimate bond.
So when you say not a lot of difference, is that one-fifth or is it tenth?
Maybe.
So it's that close.
Yeah,
okay.
I really don't see.
I think knowing the magnitude is important.
So the best benefit to us is the debt certificate as opposed to the ultimate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Plus you have a little lower authorization process requirements and legal fees because of that. Lower, you know, don't have to do the
resolution
intent
and
the
publication. Is there a preference by districts that you work with for one versus the other?
I would say the preference of, you know, looking at these two operating fund type financing options, debt certificates by 5 million.
So given our project, this is a project that are multiple funding over, could be 3 years, that's out there, the proposal, could be two, could be three. What would you recommend as far as going out with issuing?
Well, that's a good question. The first thing you got to think about is whatever you issue, you must expect to spend it in 3 years. Okay? So if you're, whatever you issue, I think looking at an increasing interest rate environment, if you go for one of these options with longer bonds where the interest rates are higher and are likely to go up, I would say do as much bonds as you can. I would say stay bank qualified under $10 million that you can spend in the next 3 years. If rates come back down like where they were last year, then you might think more. And if you had a shorter schedule, like a 10-year payback, you might think of issuing the bonds closer to the time you're going to be spending the money, because banking the money, you know you can't earn anything on it, right? So doing multiple issuance in a very low interest rate environment makes sense. But when you're expecting the rates to go up and you've got longer-term rate exposure, I think it makes more sense if you're going to do the bank qualified issue to try to do it all at once and lock in rates.
Kind of like a ladder scenario you're talking about. Could you set something like that up?
You definitely could. I mean, if let's say you're doing 8 million or 16 million, you spend 8 million this summer, 8 million the next summer, you would definitely do that in two pieces for the bank qualification. You do the first piece, I would recommend, with the longer maturities and lock those down to try to offset the interest rate risk, and then do the second part with the shorter maturities where yields are lower and you don't have as much interest rate risk. It's just my thoughts.
Liz, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We'd like to bring forward MB Financial for the next presentation. No, you're good.
You guys had something.
No, you're good. You're good. Yeah. Don't mess with
someone
children.
Drink, too.
Same thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Effectively.
This next presentation will be by MB Financial. MB, in case you don't know, is our current our banking advisor. We've been associated with MB for a number of years. This evening we have Kathy Greel and Ken Holland, both vice presidents with MB, and we'll let you begin your presentation.
Well, thank you again for the opportunity to come out and speak with you. I'm Bob Mancini with Umbrella. I've been with the bank for 7 years, as well as Ken Holland. Ken actually works in our bond group, and he'll be going through some of the details of the presentation. Like Bob referenced, the district has been with us since 2000. We've had a long relationship on the cash management depository side, just looking to grow the relationship. I'm not sure if everyone's familiar with MB Financial, but I'll give a brief little history. The bank has been around for over 100 years. We're the third largest Chicago-based bank, and we service 90 different branches throughout the Chicagoland area. So for today's presentation, we really wanted to go through the presentation on the PowerPoint slide and then go through the term sheet, and then we'll answer some questions.
So I'd like to start with this presentation here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we do, you know, with most school districts and public entities is go through a little educational piece on how we issue bonds or how we purchase bonds, as compared to maybe what you just heard from the previous presentation. We do what we call direct placement. And the first couple pages reference the types of municipal bond sales, so the public versus private, competitive negotiated sales, which you just heard from Liz. And we're the latter part, so we're a private placement. And what that means is if you look on page 7 of this presentation, this illustration is an average public sale. So there's a trustee, an issuer, an underwriter, perhaps a placement agent as well, and then bondholders, which typically are institutional investors or any number of different investors. Each one of these parties obviously has an attorney, has some kind of cost associated with it. Our model is a little bit different. And if you look on page 9, this is our model. So what we do is the school district is actually its own issue, and they would put the bonds for sale, and the bank, MB, would purchase them directly into his portfolio. We would hold it on our balance sheet, and obviously there's a significant cost savings as far as upfront costs. We don't require a credit rating. We don't require a placement agent. We don't require a letter of credit or insurance policy to back the rating. And we issue the bond on our balance sheet, the purchase onto our balance sheet, so we're using our cost of funds. So if you look on page 13, this will show a brief history of what typical bonds the index they trade on. And obviously, you know, the big spike we saw in 2008, liquidity dried up in the bond market and rate shot up, you know, almost to 8%. This would be on our balance sheet. It would use our cost of funds. It would be a low fixed rate. We wouldn't have to worry about anything happening with liquidity in the bond market. And then the next page, 14, we did, you know, it's on nice color printed paper, but this is a back of the envelope comparison of a public sale versus a direct purchase, which is what we do. So the left box there is your upfront costs, and you know, you can see underwriter fees, you know, the bond trustee, rating agencies, and so forth. And then the right box is annual fees and expenses that are typically seen in a public bond issuance. The right box does not include coupon rate, so this is anything outside of the coupon rate, which I believe would be wrapped up into the effective rate that was presented to the board. And then going on to the second packet is our term sheet. And this is our proposal to the school district. If you look on the second page, we assume a $7 million direct placement of bank-qualified bond. So we are also utilizing the bank-qualified piece. If you issue less than $10 million of debt in the fiscal year, then you're eligible for bank-qualified debt. We also assume a 10- and 15-year option. And you'll see the rates under interest rate section under 10 to 15 years, respectively. And these rates were set on October 9th, or quoted on October 9th, and they're subject, obviously, to some fluctuation in the market. We had interest payments semi-annually, no fees, so no upfront fees, no commitment fee, anything like that. Yield maintenance is a typical prepayment premium of a fixed rate, and it would be a general obligation of the school district.
And that $7 million piece is also flexible. I know we went back and forth on different dollar amounts, so we could go all the way up to $10 million. So we just showed you $7.
I'd like to open up for questions.
Rates will change accordingly, I guess you're saying. So $2 million, $7 million, $5 million?
Correct. And we can run some different scenarios if you want to see a couple different amounts and options.
And the rate that you have listed under interest rate, the option of the 10-year all and 15-year all in 3.08 and 4.02, those are subject to?
Those are subject to the fluctuations in the market. So we utilize an index and price off of the index.
Okay.
So if that index changes between now and the time of closing, that would be reflected in the rate.
And what is your index? And what is the spread index?
It's our cost of funds.
And what is this?
I'm sorry?
And what is the spread that you cost of funds?
This spread, we have 75 basis points. We also take into consideration what a similar issue would be in the public market and try to be cognizant of where those rates are, you know, compared to our rates. Mm-hmm. And the only difference you'll see between a public market rate and our rate is probably some kind of liquidity premium. So if you go the public route and you get a credit rating, if the ultimate bondholder wants to sell those bonds elsewhere, they're able to do so because it has a rating and it's liquid. If you hold down the bank's balance sheet, it's a direct purchase. We don't have the ability to do that. So we would then, if we no longer want the bond, we need to purchase a credit rating and then sell it through public channels. So that's, when I say liquidity premium, the process that a bank would need to undertake to sell the bond.
So is your rate based on, I apologize, maybe I'm just getting confused here. Is your 75 basis point on bank cost of funds or on the muni index?
It's 75 would be compared to the muni index.
The one that you guys explained in the presentation.
Right.
So
it's based on the muni index.
Yeah, not the cost of funds.
Well, that's 75 basis for it. So we can take into consideration our cost of funds and then relative to the public market issuances to make sure, you know, what
rate. But your 308 interest rate on the term sheet you provided us for the 10 years is the muni index plus 75 basis points.
It's very close to that.
Correct.
Yes, yeah, so you were talking about if you wanted, you took this on, you took on the risk as a portfolio, and then you decided that you wanted to sell it. Who bears the cost of
the bank?
Okay, so that wouldn't be our cost.
No, and it won't be likely that we'd be selling it. It was just if we ever wanted to sell it, we would have to go through and get a different a rating and then be able to sell it in the open market. But we actually just hold it on our balance sheet with a long-term relationship.
How much in this type of debt instrument or risk is MBL?
Well, so we had two departments at the bank that hold these types of debt. One is our treasury group, and that is primarily credit rate, investment grade rated bonds that we would purchase just like any institutional investor and put in our investment portfolio. And that's probably $200-300 million. Then we also do it through our group. And I'm in commercial banking, and we do this for the clients of the bank. And we purchase bonds and really treat them like a glorified commercial mortgage. And in that scenario, we probably have $75 million, maybe $100 million on our balance sheet.
So this term sheet places the district in your commercial department as opposed to
correct.
Your credit department.
Correct.
And I'm assuming that that's it's in your commercial department because of the balances that the district maintains with you.
Because of the relationship with the bank.
Okay.
And because it's not, in this scenario, this would not be a rated issuance. Whereas our treasury group would purchase rated bonds just like any other institutional investor for the investment of it. We think of this as a glorified commercial loan that we, have a relationship with the school district.
Is there a compensating balance covenant?
And then the prepayment.
Sure.
How is that calculated?
That's a yield maintenance calculation.
Any spread to the yield maintenance? Or is it a straight yield based on?
It's a straight yield based on
treasury or
present values of remaining par versus the rates in the market.
So using the reduced over a period.
Right.
Using the muni?
Assuming interest rate. Yeah.
Using a muni index or using a treasury?
Using treasury.
Correct. So there's a difference there.
Right. And we'll have that, obviously we'll provide details in the bond determination.
So what, right now, standing here, what is the difference between the 10-year muni index and the 10-year treasury?
20 bits.
Yeah, I'll have to get that. I don't have
that. So the muni index is 20 bits higher than the, or 10 bits, 20 bits higher than the treasury.
I'm not certain. I don't have those numbers.
Yeah.
Go check. So a little standard yield maintenance thing. Mm-hmm. Would you have you guys ever issued them with spread to the on the yield maintenance?
All of our yield maintenance calculations are done
straight treasury.
Correct.
Every single one. It's not treasury plus 25 bips.
We have on our commercial loans we have some spreads baked into them. So right. On a regular commercial loan you have the treasury and then 250 basis points, whatever our credit spread is. This would, we come to a fixed rate at closing, and then we would look into the treasury rate, straight treasury, for yield maintenance
calculation. I'd expect the spread to the treasury, especially when you're starting with the spread to the treasury and the moon and your the cost of the interest rate cost.
So we don't reference a spread in our rate quote, so we just provide a fixed rate.
No, I'm talking about the yield maintenance. Sorry. There's a difference already in the starting point between the yield maintenance.
Between the fixed rate and
the... Because the Treasury and the Muni Index have a spread correlated over time. I don't know what the difference is. Okay.
If it helps everyone, we can get some specific details. Maybe provide the language that we would typically provide in the bond documents and provide those you know, to you now, just to give you some more clarification.
Well, one of the questions I asked the previous presenter was locking these bonds or this issuance. What, how do you guys see that?
We as a federally regulated bank cannot enter into a derivative contract with a public entity. So we are actually prohibited from providing a forward rate lock or a swap or anything of the sort with the school district.
So you're, the rate we get is the day of the issuance?
Correct. And we could set it, I think we have in here 2 business days prior to closing is when we would typically set the rate.
So there's really no multiple funding options. We would just have to do 2 issuances.
Right. And we have a couple options. We assume like a 6-month interest only period or some various things like that to allow, you know, for construction improvements to be made. We can get creative with that kind of, you know, functionality, but it would be a single draw, a single bump.
Could you get creative on your amortization with our existing bond payment?
Yes. Yes, we could structure the amortization however the school district would like.
With the existing bonds?
No, just so the payment stream's a little...
Considering. And, you know, obviously there'd be some rate repercussions, you know, whether it be negative or positive, if we, you know, backload amortization and things like that. But we can certainly show you those options.
And fees and costs,
we made some assumptions, and I think we used the... $25,000 for bond council. It would be issuer council,
10 to 15,
and then the bank's council, which would be 10 to 15, and that's it.
This rate is that negotiable at all?
Sure. I mean, we can continue the discussion on rate if we need to.
You know, you've got 3 bankers.
We warned them.
In addition to the savings that you showed us on the chart, what's the advantage of going this route?
Well, I think the advantage is that you have a single bondholder, and you have an existing relationship with the bank. So if there's any issues, you know, obviously we're more willing to work with you on those than a institutional investor that just so happens to be holding the bond at that time. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, upfront costs and ease of issuance, and that's it.
Kind of going to Joe's comment, I think we have more willingness to kind of customize. So if you guys are looking for an interest only payment or, you know, for 9 months or 12 months, we'll work mm-hmm. to kind of customize a little bit more because we have the flexibility.
Thank you.
How many districts do you have in the commercial area?
School districts?
I think it's school districts.
We work with 150 different municipal agencies. Of that, about 20 to 25 are school districts.
Okay. So that's kind of a good niche. That.
Correct. Hey, I'm a non-banker. So obviously you're recommending the private sale versus the public sale.
Right.
So is there any scenario where we would be going with the public sale? That you would not recommend, but accept, I guess?
We could play a part in a public sale. So if you went with an underwriter or a placement agent, they would prepare the bond to be issued to the public. They would reoffer it to the public. And we can certainly be on that list and certainly provide a proposal, provide a quote to purchase that bond. Whether we win in that competitive sale, it depends on how many investors are involved, how many quotes they receive.
And this would be placed with our treasury group versus the commercial group, so it's kind of a different, a little bit more of a disconnect.
So we could certainly play a part, but it would be, you know, the more investors that are involved in that process, the less likely that they would be on the purchase.
Okay. Thank you.
One more quick question. How does the bond collateralize?
It's a general obligation.
Okay.
Of school insurance.
It's not specific.
Not your house or anything. Don't worry
about it. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciated it. Bob and I wanted to make sure that the board had two very different perspectives on this issue, and that's why you had a William Blair and an MB come forward tonight to present their thinking, although very different way of going about doing this work. So with that, I'll hand it back to you, Sam.
Okay, moving on. Public participation. I'd like to remind members of the audience that while the board provides opportunities for visitors to express their opinions at specific times in the agenda, speakers should identify themselves, complete the public participation form, and limit their comments to not more than 3 minutes, including any summary or concluding comments. Personal complaints and criticism about staff members, students, or other members of the District 41 community should be initiated privately with the appropriate district representative. This will be more productive toward achieving an effective resolution of the problem and minimize the risks of breach of confidentiality, invasion of privacy, and defamation claims against both the district and the speaker. Also, profanity, interruption, and or other interference with the orderly conduct of the meeting are not permitted. All questions raised will be forwarded to the appropriate D41 staff representative for a response, if a response is warranted. Is there anyone present who would like to address the board at this time? Seeing none, we'll move on. Presentations, reports, and initiatives. The 2014 elementary school facility planning.
So the presentation tonight, I'll be handing it off to Bob here in a moment to go through it, but we've brought forward the financial experts in their field for you guys to ask, for the board to ask questions. We're now going to be bringing forward our architects from FGM. We'll also be introducing our new construction manager, FQC. Jack will be leading that presentation. But we wanted to ensure that the board had another opportunity to see some of the drawings. We're further along than we were 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago now. We're excited about the flexibility of the classroom spaces. We've been working diligently to create a dynamic learning environment in each of our schools while we're still with that focus of reducing the reliance on the portables at each of our elementary schools. We believe that this idea, this concept, meets many of those, if not all of the directives that the board has given to us to continue to search for. With that, I'll hand it over to Bob.
Thank you. So, as you can see, you have a packet in front of you that the cabinet spent considerable time putting together. You've had an opportunity to review that, and I'll just take some time and walk through that with you. I wanted to introduce a couple of our professional partners, Ron Richardson with FGM Architects and Jack Hayes with FQC, recently been hired as the district construction manager as we move forward in the next couple of years for construction projects. So,
thanks.
You can join me if you care to.
I'll jump in when you're ready for us. We're going to move over sort of a little bit more simply. We'll get into the conversation.
So I guess Ron's going to take a couple minutes while he's getting ready there. I would just like to walk you through an introduction to our presentation this evening. We have spent a number of years in master facility planning, basically since I came aboard about over 6 years ago. We at one time or another have been on MFP throughout that time. There are various members that have sat on those committees, others that have participated. So this isn't new. This isn't a new conversation. If But what is relatively new is the fact that we've brought forth a plan now that actually will reduce the district's reliance upon portables. You have a plan in front of you here that will, at the minimum, reduce our portables by four at Ben Franklin, four at Churchill, two at Abraham Lincoln, and four at Forest Glen. And that could be accomplished over a relatively short period of time, beginning in the summer of 2014 and finishing up summer-fall of 2015. So the plan that you have in front of you is going to present for four classrooms, a minimum of four classrooms additions at each of the elementary schools. We have at least preliminarily, schematically designed these to be flexible learning spaces with a number of different portable types of equipment, sinks, but retractable partition walls, movable cabinetry, and things of that nature. All will be a minimum of 900 square feet, which is larger, or is at least as large as our typical classroom, some of which are really only about 650 or 700 square feet. The classroom additions that we are proposing, there'll be a flexible wall, retractable wall between each of the two classrooms, which can open up into a bigger single space, or again, can be shared together. They will incorporate outdoor learning environments at each one of our elementary schools. And again, we plan to be able to complete these over the next two or three summers. The purpose of this evening's conversation is for us to present our initial thoughts to you and for you, the board, to ask questions of our professional partners as well as the administrative team. Anything that we can ask, you can ask of us, we'd be happy to answer. Next up is October 28th. We'll be bringing a refined presentation to you where we believe we'll have significantly more defined cost estimates as our construction managers have really been on the job now for about 2 weeks, and the plan is for us to have those numbers revised and back to the administrative team early next week, and again presented to the board on the 28th. And then we'll be looking for board support as we move forward with the bid process at that first meeting in November. Now you have a number of different plans in front of you, different timelines. I thought I would just I'll walk through briefly what I think I can contribute to the conversation, and we'll get Jack involved, and Ron will be doing some presenting also. You have what I would consider a matrix in front of you also on the second page of that first tab. It shows the difference between our existing classrooms and our flexible classrooms. I think I've gone over that, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Under tab 2, you begin to see what the layouts will look. We have site plans, interior sort of design layouts, where the recommended classroom space will fit in on the existing interior. And then also we have some exterior shots in terms of what they'll look like and how they'll fit into the community, into the neighborhood. Obviously the first one there is Franklin. That addition would go on to the back of the building to the south end of the existing facility. We have Lincoln next, and that addition, four classroom addition, is proposed for the west end of the building. Eliminating the two portables that are currently in the north end or north back side of Lincoln, and then moving the existing four portable classroom pod back to where those two classrooms are currently sitting. We then have Churchill, which shows this bar of extended classrooms to the north of the existing facility. This area, this classroom space will actually have four teaching stations plus an art studio. And because of the position in the building itself, we thought advisable that we add restroom facilities onto that area. It also does provide for some underground detention as well as additional playground space.
I think it's key to note here that because of the art studio, the addition of the art studio was because we had to effectively use where that music studio currently resides. we needed a lot of that space for the corridor, for the hallway to lead into the next station, so we needed to make that space up with an additional art studio.
And then finally, what would Forest Glen look like? That addition would actually be on the west end of that building, again, providing for underground detention, because we, as you well know, we're a landlocked community and we're always looking for additional resources. I also wanted to mention to you that we had our second meeting with the village this morning. Thought it went very well. Myself, Ron, village personnel, as well as a representative from FQC. We had our initial meeting about 10 days ago, came back this morning and spoke with their stormwater experts. And I believe that they felt very good about the plan. First of all, with the reduction of our use of portables in the district, and then also our plans for underground detention. They have a good feeling for that. We talked about timelines, and we don't anticipate many issues with Franklin because of the existing storm field. Maybe some minor adjustments may need to be made to tie into that existing system. I would think a particular interest that we've heard is with regards to Lincoln. And our recommendation is that we're going to continue to move forward with designing Lincoln with the addition on the far west end of the property, but also parallel track and go for permitting, follow the permitting process for an underground detention on the east side of the property, which would have underground detention as well as possible parking spaces to alleviate congestion and safety issues and things of that nature. But it is advised that we keep those two application and permitting processes separate from one another in case we do run into an issue with the underground detention. That won't stop the construction on the west wing with the addition at Lincoln. In your next sections here, or just behind the site plans, we're showing what the interior layouts will be and how they sit, again, on a more highly defined area within the building itself, near Franklin. Also, as we move through the presentation, Ron is going to have some shots of what the exteriors will look like that we can share with the audience this evening. And I think you'll notice that they fit in very nicely with the existing facility. We were told by the village to, in order to allow this process to be rather streamlined and hopefully not come into any particular issues, we would need to go before their permitting, their planning board. And basically what they're looking for is how does the proposed structure fit in with the existing facility, the neighborhood. They're always concerned about lighting, off-street parking. There's four, and I can't remember that fourth particular issue that they'll be looking at. But in either case, we again plan on meeting with them on a regular basis, and I think we're talking about another meeting within the next week or so, just to keep this process moving forward quickly. So again, you see some exterior shots of what the Franklin building will look like. And then we move through Lincoln, Churchill, and Forest Glen. Do you have any questions at this time that I might be able to address? If not, then I'll move on to Jack Hayes and let him briefly. He's going to talk about FQC's input in the timeline and in the budgeting process as we move forward. Any questions?
Okay. I had a question on the layout. Let me find my tab here. But at Lincoln, it looked like we were separating the two classrooms.
Are you looking at the images?
Do you want me to pull it up?
No.
Yes or no?
No.
Okay.
I mean, if you want to. At Lincoln, it looked like we were separating. You know, we had always talked about in the previous discussions around additions and buildings, trying to keep this four-pack together so we could leverage space and teachers and all that, and it just looks like we've separated them. I'm just wondering why we couldn't just put them together. I didn't know if there was something creating that.
Yeah, there was the reason they were split is so that we can maintain natural daylight into the kindergarten classroom. If we put inboard classrooms, and that blocks all your natural daylight. That was the logic. And also,
so you cut half of the daylight out of the other two rooms, but they still get daylight.
Correct. At the end.
And then, as the plan is laid out for Lincoln, I spoke earlier of the stormwater needs. In between those two additions that we're planning in the west end of Lincoln, we're putting some underground detention, about 15,000 cubic feet, to handle detention just for that specific area of the building, so that we can keep the permitting moving forward. We're concerned that if we were to put all the stormwater on the east end of the property, and something that held up with the stormwater permitting, that it may delay the construction of that building on the west end in the spring. So you would have ultimately two separate stormwater systems. You would have one on the west end where the new addition is going, and then something on the east end where we would eventually put underground detention, as well as some what would hope to be a parking lot with off-street parking, alleviating safety and traffic congestion.
And then just we're talking about the schematics, right? So again, based on our previous discussions around space, these are flexible rooms, but they don't really contain some of the other space that we've discussed before that you want to have in these rooms, such as a place for two or three kids to go to in their own little private area.
That extended learning. Well, the extended learning has been, you'll see it in the presentation, we're going with outdoor classrooms, but the integrated resources, I think, is what you're referencing. The little pull-out spaces, correct, there are no small pull-out zones. They're simple four classroom additions. But we are integrating that sort of exterior space, creating exterior areas where we can do that sort of pull-out.
So that's what we call an integrated learning space.
Well, I believe you're referencing the little pull-out spaces one-on-one, and this does not have any of those components in there.
But this will be designed much in line with what we're doing currently with our existing facilities, and that is providing a teaching wall, smart board, and that type of technology, as well as carpeted or smaller areas where kids can work independently or work with small groups with the teacher. Yes, Paul?
We're going to take a moment and return to our regular scheduled programming, where we will do public participation one more time. We did one round of public participation, but generally we do it at 7:30. I noticed a number of public community members coming in, and I know they wanted to speak, so to respect them and our time and their time, we feel like it would be important to pause for a moment and allow, I think we have three, Maureen? Okay.
Any objection from any board members on that? Okay. All right, Maureen, who's first?
On the matter of the 420-foot-hour hotel bill at the Renaissance Schomburg, I contacted five board members over 2 weeks ago, asking specific questions and looking for individual answers and thoughts as to how to bring common sense and reasonableness to the district's spending. Today, I finally received an answer that could lead to some better parameters on spending the public dollars. The Finance Committee needs to act on travel in the areas of overnight stay and mileage reimbursement. Overnight stay should be disallowed at conferences of less than 50 miles from the district. Taxpayers travel similar distances daily to work. On mileage reimbursement, if more than one person drives to location, no one should drive alone. Riders should only be reimbursed for the difference, if any, between their normal commute to work and the distance of the person driving on the designated trip. The Finance Committee also needs to take a thorough look into the administrator's contract starting with the next school year. The benefit that allows taxpayers to be billed for a health club membership needs to be eliminated for starters. I feel comfortable saying that no one will leave employment here, and we won't miss hiring a good candidate because of this. Thank you.
Thank you. Mrs. Stecker, anyone else? Mrs. Clark, are you ready?
I'm not interested.
Okay. Anyone else?
I'm supposed to submit.
to Mrs. Stecker in the back there.
Yeah. However, you can sit, you can stand, whatever you're most comfortable.
Just tell us your name and.
I'm Shayna Frederick, and we were here on behalf of the modified instructional program here at Ben Franklin, and we just came to publicly thank the teachers and administrators for partnering with us as we explored some other options to make the learning environment for our children the best possible environment. That could be, and we really appreciate the time and effort that was put in by everyone, and we really want to publicly thank the teachers especially for their flexibility, their professionalism, and their dedication to our children. We really appreciate it, and just want to say thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
I'm Joyce Webb, and I am also the parents of a child in MIP classroom. And I am also grateful for the collaborative work we were able to accomplish with the board, the teachers, the district. However, I was quite dismayed by the entire process and the light that was shown upon the special education program in the district. We did a lot of background work on behalf of all the parents in the classroom. We spoke to different districts. We spoke to different advocates. We studied different models. And frankly, I think we have two significant issues here. One is that the issue that special ed is outsourced needs to be examined more closely. I think it is a big deficit to this district and what they can provide in terms of forward thinking and progressive platforms for special ed. And I was really disheartened because we got some fabulous teachers in the district, and we've got a lot of needy kids, and I think we have a lot of needy kids that are actually in general education that probably are going unidentified, that could benefit from some of the more progressive special ed models that are out there in the other districts. And my proposal here is that this is just the beginning of the study of how special ed is treated in this district. So I haven't thought it through further about what we should do about it, but I'm glad we came to a very good resolution for this particular problem, but frankly, it only shined the light on a much bigger issue for me. And so I look forward to working with the district and the parents further to better improve what we can offer the kids now and in the future. Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else, Mrs. Stecker?
Yeah. We're good to know.
Okay. Anyone come in late that wants to publicly participate? All right. So we'll go back to our Bob and our presentation.
Okay. So we'll move on to the next section this evening, and that will be discussion of timeline. And I know Jack was also going to speak to cost determination and how we're going to move forward with that. So, yeah.
Thanks, Bob. And hello, everyone. I'm Jack Hayes. I'm the president of Frederick Twain Corporation. I work with FTC. And it's my first time formally in front of you, so it's great to be here. I appreciate the opportunity. I've been to a few board meetings in the past and met a few of you, so should be a little bit familiar. With me tonight is Fred Morano. He's a principal of FTC. He's also our chief estimator, so he's really our numbers guy. So if I stumble, Fred can jump in and make sure that we answer your questions. But in TF3, what we provided Bob was kind of our first blush response to what Ron and his folks at FGM have done with the scheduling for the proposed improvements at the four schools. And what you have is kind of a one-page summary of what I consider to be kind of the key milestone activities that have to occur over the next few months to get us to the point where we can be building the additions at Franklin and potentially Lincoln next summer. And I say potentially because, of as you know, the stormwater issue is going to be the critical path item in pretty much every conversation. So if I say it tonight, you know, just kind of take it that that's part of every conversation that we have every time we meet. They had a good meeting today. I had a good conversation with the same gentleman when we were in the interviewing process, so that I did my homework. That doesn't mean anything until we have a permit to do it. So from a design and construction standpoint, I don't see any complication in getting to doing both Franklin and Lincoln next summer. It's all going to be about appearance reviews, stormwater permitting reviews, and so forth. So that's what this schedule reflects. If everything goes ideally, what we're looking at is Franklin for sure next summer, Lincoln with permitting and approvals next summer, and then going into the summer of 2015 with both Churchill and Forest Glen. The only thing that could potentially get extended into 2016 is if there's anything with regard to site restoration, and most likely that would be something at Churchill if there was anything. But most likely, the work should be completed by the fall, mid-year of the 2015 school year.
So what is site restoration? What could it mean?
Really, at that point, landscaping. Because we have to do all the BMPs for stormwater management during construction. So all the structures will be in place. The stormwater detention will be in place. But site restoration in terms of landscaping, maybe some hardscape surfaces, if there's any sidewalks or paving that we're putting on a temporary basis, we need to go back into final paving. Taking the portables out, for example, at Churchill is going to have to follow construction, and there'll probably be some site restoration at that location where those portables come out. So it'll be that kind of work.
There can't be any overlap in that. I mean, it looks like site restoration has to be done before we start moving. I mean,
Jack, I'm not sure if you said that, but construction completion is in December. That's what's driving the site restoration piece. It's not linear because you have to wait until the spring months.
Weather.
Yeah.
Weather.
There's some parallel activity with construction. You can do some site restoration.
Stabilization.
While construction is almost done.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Right. There's some overlap.
Yes.
We're going to be driving trucks over your lawns. Bringing masonry and concrete and so forth up to your buildings. And so as that work winds down and so forth, we'll be able to do some of that. But final site restoration, and it's just a
part of
really right now, this is just kind of our safety belt. If we have to do it in the spring, that would be the worst case.
Yeah, you're not going to plant trees in December or January.
Yeah, I appreciate not planting trees in December, but that doesn't mean you can't move the kids into the rooms where they
fall. Site restoration doesn't have anything to do with
it. They are moved in.
Yeah.
No, the construction work will be done mid-year of
2015. Sorry, but just for clarity, this page here where you have the milestones, this is only for Franklin and Lincoln.
Correct. Yeah, that's the work that we need to do so that we can get Franklin and Lincoln up and running by this summer.
But in the design and pre-construction phase where you have the schematic designs and the cost estimates and all that? Those are for all four?
Yes.
The milestone date for all four would not be October 2013, I think.
I'm sorry, say that again?
If these are milestone dates, the schematic design is October 2013.
Right.
But I would assume that the schematic designs do not need to be complete by October 2013 for all four sites. I know they pretty much are, but...
Yeah. For estimation purposes, the goal was to pull everything along
right.
at the same pace to give you a snapshot of where all the buildings are at a certain point in time, with two of them moving forward, because, you know, due to time constraints, the only two moving forward would be Lincoln.
But the initial design work will be completed this fall.
Right.
And then we'll be going out to bid for Lincoln and Franklin December, January for construction next summer. We wouldn't bid those other two buildings until later next year.
Right, and that's where, for me, that's why this chart didn't work, because it was milestones for Franklin and Lincoln, but there's a lot of work. You know, I'd like to see a milestone for each building so we know when we have to either make the decision or spend the money. Which that wasn't, you know, for here it said that, but now...
But those dates are on the bar chart schedule, I think, a little bit more in detail, but they're probably not broken down as...
Well, on the bar chart, they all say schematic designs need to be done for October, and I can, not knowing anything about construction, can assure you that schematic designs probably do not need to be done for all four buildings.
For our approval process, though, can we step back? Don't we want them all done?
That's what our...
So that we can approve this and the timeline that's set forth in front of us?
We were trying to keep that process connected for all four. And then Churchill and Forest Glen design development would lag behind the development of Lincoln and Franklin.
Strictly because it has extra plumbing issues with the stormwater to work with on the
site. But if we keep schematic design linked for all four and the cost estimating process linked for all four, then when we come back to you in October or November, then you have the same level of integrity of information for the entire project scope.
Yep, I understand that. So if the schematics aren't done by the end of this month, we are behind schedule for our project. That's what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Any other questions for Jeff?
And just that you're going to be fine-tuning this schedule throughout the process.
Right.
This is a really broad stroke schedule, because when I look at it, I hope that it can shrink, especially in the fall months.
Yeah, and we have taken a generous look at it at this point. We've even had conversations about, you know, how quickly can these additions be built. And when you look at it in context of the physical hard construction of those classrooms, that piece right now has a lot more level of detail attached to it than everything else on the site. And that's the piece that we just, you know, we can't attach any real intelligence to this, because the process isn't far enough along to know what we're going to get pushback on from a construction standpoint.
Bob, just a quick question. When we put the classrooms down to have it, and we had the air funds, 3 years ago, was it?
Four.
What was the timeline for that?
We started construction in April and finished on time for classroom, for them to get into classrooms by the third week of August.
We put a temporary fire exit in over spring break, and then that gave the contractor access starting in April, finished in August.
Okay, thank you.
And that's one of the things that when we first kind of joined the party, we were looking at that as well to see if that was something. In most school projects, we can start outside the building before school is out of session, mm-hmm. and get a lot of work done while the kids are still there. In this particular case, in most cases, your portables are right in the way of where we need to build. So that we have to wait till school's out. So then it pushes it into the fall schedule, and so it has the complications.
Mm-hmm. In with regard to the portables, I know that we've seen documents that talk about what it costs to take them down. Is there any way to minimize some of those costs? Or
we'll take a look at it. I mean, off the top of my head, I don't have a good answer for it. Something we need to take a look at.
You know, like the two portables at the back of Lincoln, those really aren't worth saving. So we would come in, demo, and remove them.
Okay. So it just depends on what we're going to do with them.
That's correct.
And your legend, you have red as critical activity.
That's just a function of the program. And that one, having been entered into the system first, it just created a critical path activity gap.
So that we shouldn't read that as critical path.
No, you shouldn't. As the detail gets added to the schedule, we'll do a full task item for each school, which will have its own critical path schedule by school.
One thing that I think is important when we look at site plans next time around is where the existing portables are, and we have to figure out where they're going to go. In Lincoln, it's kind of known because the two are going to go down in the back, and before that, where the additions are going to be moved back there. But at the other schools, it'd be good to know logistically how we're going to handle that.
Right. I agree with Eric. Obviously, we want to reduce the cost as much as we can with that. But also, we have to take into consideration your structure, your construction zone, you know, proximity to that, and construction traffic and all that. I know you know how to do it, but it's something I would like to see on the site plan so that I can take it in.
Yeah, from a logistics standpoint, so, sure.
Because we'd also probably have to change what's in those rooms too, right? So would we, if we move one portable from one side of the building to the other, will it impact who's in those portables and all of that? So,
it could.
Yeah. So yes. Next year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Jack, thank you.
Sorry, but according to the timeline then, by the 28th of this month, we need to, as a board, approve moving forward.
Well, our terminology here might be a little bit stronger than your process because we're getting familiar with the three-step process. Mm-hmm. We are going to be bringing for the 28th board meeting, you will have in your packet an SD cost estimate from us. We've been working with Ron and understanding how he built the numbers that you've seen so far, which is what's in this packet. Mm-hmm. Fred has been working through those and building his own spreadsheets based on what we're hearing. We've been through several meetings. We have a lot of detail. So our objective is to give you an SD estimate from Frederick Quinn in your 28th board packet. And I apologize. I don't know if they're being asked for approval.
We'd be looking.
No,
not on the 28th.
The next meeting,
so it'll be the 11th.
It'd be the 11th of November that we would.
28th.
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So our terminology might be a little bit off here in the schedule.
One other question about the numbers. There was a note here around, and I know Patrick had brought this up, but a note around our 2010 cost for the Hadley Edition was a higher cost bid award. And these are, you know, higher. My question wasn't so much that as much as the lead-off, which is, what's the difference now between 2010 and now in terms of any leverage you have or we have in bidding? Is it still a good market for that, or I mean, what do you
think? Yeah, I still think it's a good market as far as bidding process. And usually if we go out for bid at the beginning of the year, early winter time situation, it's always a good time for bidding because it's you try to get that first job out of the whole market, and people tend to bid a little tighter at that point. As they start picking up work, then their prices are a little higher. But, you know, this being pricing for materials is still going up, labor rates are still going up, so there's still going to be an increase in cost, of course. But
we also discussed the opportunity for some savings by bidding two projects together in a single year. So we might see some savings next year as a result of doing Lincoln and Franklin together. Whether we have the same contractors or not remains to be seen, but it might provide us some leverage during the bidding process. Mm-hmm. And then again for the following year with Forest Glen and Churchill.
We can build a bid packages so that we can ask for a contractor to give us individual prices for each school, and we can take the lowest contractor, and we can also ask that same contractor, if you get both, we can reduce your cost and ask for a credit that way.
So, Bob, I did ask that question for clarity's sake. The Hadley was at $277 the square foot and worth twice as high on these, and at $423 on the low end. Why did nearly 100% increase?
And I sent you an email late this afternoon. I didn't have an opportunity to get to it earlier. Those that 272, 254, 272 range is building cost only. The other figure, the higher figure, is the one that's baked in with site management, construction management, all the other details, fire exit construction, and 15 different items that are in that higher figure versus the actual building cost.
Did that building cost in your assumptions include the interior build out too, or no?
Yes.
The 252 to 270. That was shell and interior.
Yeah, all part of finishes and so forth.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yes.
What we're actually finding, what Fred is finding, is that the numbers that we're seeing on a cost per square footage basis for the vertical construction, you know, the foundations on up, not the site, is very consistent with what this conversation. And what numbers are you, 270 or 250?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the range. Our hard cost of construction is very similar to what you've been seeing from Ron and what you experienced on Hadley. The big variable here is going to be your site.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It could drive your, because these are small additions. You know, you got small additions and you have whatever the dollar value is. If you have $500,000 of site work and you've got a 5,000 square foot addition, you're $100 a square foot just in site. In some cases, you might be $200 a square foot just in site. So those are just, you know, don't quote me on that. That's just what are we going to do with site is what's going to drive your total.
Can you remind us why site work's so high?
I'm sorry?
Remind us why the site work cost is so high.
All because of the stormwater permitting requirements.
And so if we fix the stormwater, does it have added benefits to the school as a whole and not just to these additions?
To the school as a whole? The property as a whole?
Is a programmatic issue? Yes. For instance, and it's site by site. Every case is different, but Forest Glen will be draining the play area. So it will be better, it will be drier, more usable.
And that's why it's dangerous to use a per square foot price
on
additions, because you're actually improving the whole school by making this improvement. The correct way to do it was divided by the square footage of the school as a whole.
Or in many cases, you divide it by the acreage of the
property. Right, I agree, but to get to a building.
Yeah.
Because you're improving the whole building.
Right.
I mean, they can go out at recess and actually play on the equipment. Or they can go out at PE and get into the back of Lincoln where it's wet. Bob told me 90%
most of the time. Most Churchill, of the same thing, beyond the playground in the back of Churchill is wet. And we hear that comment and that complaint from building principals frequently, is that if we could, they'd like to see underground detention to promote greater green space and so that they can use the fields more effectively throughout the year. It's an ongoing complaint that we've heard for a number of years.
I look at that expense as one that is everlasting for all the needs of that green space, be it PE, recess, or whatever else it is. It's something that's been needed. If we're doing these additions, it's a great time to do it.
Now's the time to vary.
It's an awesome.
Well, but the site work isn't optional. It's mandatory.
Mandatory. Yeah,
it's a code requirement. So you're going to do expansion, you're going to do site work.
And you're going to have the benefit that it gives you in other areas besides the addition.
Right.
But just a little historical perspective, and Ken's got to go. You've heard the board push back on the underwater detention a lot because of the cost and what's the benefit. So I just want to kind of capture this moment here because, I mean, we've been talking about this over time. Hadley is a great example of that when we buried it in Franklin, too. But we're reaping some of the benefit of it and looking at how to do this construction.
Well, I'll tell you that I believe even the village recognizes that, is because when we started our conversations with the village, they have, you know, two things they've been very happy with is that we're eliminating, reducing our reliance upon portables, and then the second one is the fact that we are bringing recommendations that provide for underground detention. From what I understand, for a number of years, the area around Ben Franklin used to flood, and we've had some pretty significant rainfalls over the past couple of years, and we don't receive the same complaints. They used to say that the water literally used to sheet off our property. Well, we don't hear that anymore. And same thing with at Hadley, too. We're able to account for our own stormwater now instead of it just coming rolling off our property. We're retaining it within on our site.
Bob, the budget updates. I know you've got...
Drew, sorry to interrupt you, but could you tell us all where you are in the packet so we can follow along?
Oh, I'm on tab...
Spreadsheet. Four. Tab 4, spreadsheet.
Page 4, page 1.
Thank you.
The in the budget updates, you've got water detention for Churchill, and you've got it for Lincoln, but not Forest Glen.
Forest Glen is built into the base bid.
Okay, we need to. The original goal, we created alternates to track additional stormwater for those sites. So at Churchill, the hope was that we could. If you remember, the original scope was to replace part of the building, right? To replace the building, and so we weren't really increasing the footprint. We were going to try to take down and put back. That was our original scope. So out of that came a desire to track an alternate to drain the fields in the back. So So that structure continued to move forward until we had more data on the classroom bar that's coming off the back of the school. So, in reality, what you need to do is it's being tracked as an alternate, but you have to do both of these. And that's the way we've been tracking this, is that we need to drain the fields, we need to provide storm water, and we need to... And so we're not going to modify the basin because we don't want to do that anymore, so we're going to bury it and drain the fields. So pretty much we want to be accepting Churchill alternate 2 and the base bid of Churchill. Now, at Lincoln, again, it's a similar situation. You know, back in August, September, we were thinking take down and replace, you know, sort of a very minimal impact as far as pervious or impervious surface. So we were going to track an alternate again to modify that basin to bury it. So that was the original scope when we started out, and that's why you see the other alternates are zeroed out. We're tracking the same alternates, the same structure. So, but now, you know, things have really changed at Lincoln, so now we're self-contained over on the far west side. We're not going to touch that basin on the east side. So there's no need to even track this alternate anymore. It's going to vanish. Although it will come back as a different project. Like Bob said, we're going to be tracking storm water on the east side and parking and field drainage in a separate package on a separate track so that that can continue to move forward depending on the board's wishes, you know, as far as getting that done.
So are we saying that these alternative underground detention numbers should not be factored into our totals at this point?
No, I'm saying that it's the Churchill alternate needs to be factored into our high and low budget.
Okay.
And then, but the Lincoln, the scope has changed over the last 2 months, and it's not relevant. This alternate isn't relevant anymore in this structure. But this was back in the mid September.
The Churchill, yes.
And then, do these costs include taking down? I mean, we're going to get rid of 16 portables here if we move forward with this.
Mm-hmm.
So, are those costs associated with getting rid of the portables
and site restoration associated with removing portables?
And then there should be some
mobile relocation too is included in
this number. Okay.
Now, and I would argue that Bob can probably get a better deal if he works directly with the mobile manufacturer rather than channeled through FQC.
And then there should be some savings in here as well, right? If we're going to get rid of 16 of them, can't we sell some of them?
Well, it depends. We own some and we lease some. We lease some and we own some.
So there should be some savings, right?
Should be. Yeah. Should be. We pay about $140,000 a year in annual lease payments. But like the one we own, the one at the back of Lake, if we own that, and it's needs to be replaced.
Yeah. Nobody's buying that.
No.
But you're not saying put those in this number, are you?
Well, I'm saying we should try to understand what the savings are.
Okay.
Because they are in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there will be savings in the overall budget, but right. Not construction.
Right, right. Yeah, okay. We still have to pay for this, but it'd be nice to understand what our savings is from the 16 portables.
So we've touched on tab number 4, which is the preliminary cost estimates. We've seen these numbers before. They're consistent with what we have provided to the board. The process now is we're working throughout this week and early next week to come up with revised projections and cost estimates, and that information will be provided to you at the board meeting on the 28th of October.
So there's the total hard cost, total soft cost, total cost, lows and highs. Can we say with any certainty that these numbers will be accurate? Are they low? Are they high? Or do we know at this point?
That's what next week is for, as far as the next board meeting.
We hope to be less than the high, for sure. So,
we do.
That's obviously the goal, to get down as low as possible. But on the 28th, we'll have a new process, a new number, and more information, more detail.
Okay.
So we're in the $14 to $20 million range for all in?
On the high end.
All in. Yes. Yeah. $14 to $29
million. Yep.
Okay, I thought there was another question. Okay, so next up we will have Ron giving his presentation this evening, and that will be under tab 6. So, Ron, I'll let you run.
Bob, are you going to run some of the slides, too?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. And Bob went through some of this information with you already, but what you're going to see in here is an updated version. So, in fact, it's slightly different.
It's
going to change tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's just a work in progress.
That's me.
Snapshot.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
Agenda overview here. I wanted to share with you the design process because we never really had a chance to talk about that, so I'll make it really brief, but I'll give you a quick tutorial on the architectural design process and how that fits in with FQC's efforts. I'd like to reiterate the design objectives since we had a lot of discussions in August and changes. Wanted to go through that with you, and then you can verify for yourself if we're hitting those targets. Design schedule. Jack spoke about the construction schedule a few minutes ago, so I'd like to sort of out of sequence a little bit, but I'd like to go through the design schedule with you to queue up some of the decisions that we'll need to make in the design process, and then actually the actual design presentation itself with some updates to the images. All right. Typically, the design architectural design process is a four-step process, and we start out with programming, schematic design development, and construction documents is the final process, and that's what you normally see. We make drawings. I mean, that's what you normally see, but that's actually the last piece of the puzzle. All right, the programming phase, that's where we establish the vision, the value, the image, the flexibility, and we've had those discussions pretty much back in August, and then, as I said, we sort of modified that program in early September, and then that's what you see today. So that phase was completed, although it was very much an abbreviated process because of the size of the project. Schematic design, that's where we are today, and it's a broad look. It's actually taking it's actually establishing the design, I guess is a better way to put it. To give you the three-dimensional ideas of spaces. And it's fair to say that you're seeing a lot more detail in this schematic design effort than you normally see, because we want to make sure that you're comfortable with what you see in terms of finishes and quality and volumes of spaces, because this is a unique solution to each and every site. So we probably went beyond what we normally do in schematic design, but that's fine. That's the deal. All right. Design development is actually the next phase. That's where we present to you. You approve the schematic design. We continue to meet with the administration and get feedback from staff, site staff, administrative staff. Then we move into the design development, where we instead of just showing a door, we now show a wood door. You know, and it's that kind of detail. We start to fill in some of the pieces, and the floor plan starts to solidify. Based on budget, and it's really sort of a design/budget exercise. I mean, there's always that back check, and then we react to the budget. If we can add more, or we need to take things away, we do that at each and every phase. And then finally, construction documents. That's where we put it all together. We articulate all of the specifications and schedule, and it's a very lengthy process. There's a lot of communication and a lot of input from Frederick Quinn. And then the project goes out to bid. All right, so Franklin, and you're going to see a discrepancy in the schedules, because I was always tracking Franklin as a standalone project moving forward. So you'll have to read in here Franklin and Lincoln, okay, because that's our goal now. But they're going to track in the same fashion. So programming phase, completed schematic design phase will be done by the end of next week. Design development and construction document phase. There may not be a clean break between those two phases. We will probably do estimate updates, but we're going to continue to make that schedule because the schedule is very tight, as you know, in order to hit that December out the bid date, this early January out the bid date. So that's our goal. And then now, so Forest Glen and Lincoln.
Churchill.
Okay, so yes, Churchill and Forest Glen. Programming, schematic design. Then we think that design development may start back up in January because it's going to track behind the other two projects, but that's fluid and that's flexible. But there, as everyone has said before, there are a lot of site infrastructure needs over Churchill with site grading and stormwater. So the civil engineers may continue to work through that process for permitting reasons. But from a design standpoint, we may pick it up again in January and run with that so that Frederick Quinn can then move forward with a bidding cycle on that one, too. But that schedule has to be ironed out and looked at. All right, design goals. A quick recap, because we talked to the administration, and FGM talks about this every week. But so we wanted to share that with you, because it's kind of a good forum for that. Our goal was to create new flexible classroom spaces to accommodate varied learning needs, create additions that complement the existing architecture that have their own design and identity, create new spaces that could be converted to STEAM labs in the future. So we put the infrastructure in there for that conversion, but they will function and they're designed as classrooms. And provide as much equity between buildings as possible, maximize natural daylighting, and bury stormwater below grade where feasible.
Can I ask a question about the STEAM, if you go back to that? I mean, my assumption has been two of these rooms would be literacy and two of them would be STEAM. Maybe that's a bad assumption, but why are we creating spaces that will be converted to STEAM? If I were
maybe converted to STEAM?
It gives you that possibility to convert. They can stay classrooms for the next 50 years if you wanted them to, or they could be subdivided into smaller pull-out sections. There's a lot. You'll see in the design that there's an enormous amount of flexibility.
Assumption I'm making that if we're adding four to Ben Franklin, let's say the fifth graders go there, that's where they are today, maybe in the portables, that it wouldn't be a four-pack, and maybe two of them will go to third graders and two of them will go to second graders.
It'd be a piece that we'd be working with our principals to design the layout, where students are located, how we're using that space, and that's something that we talk about each year, is how do we use our space within our buildings. But ultimately, they are classrooms, they're flexible, they can be used for a multitude of uses, and that really was the intent behind this.
So they're not STEAM labs.
But they all have water in them, and in K-5 students within the science, that's the extent. They don't use gas, they don't use anything else within those science labs, or the next generation standards aren't asking for those pieces either. So we wanted to ensure that those classrooms, if the school so choose, they certainly could use them as their STEAM classroom, or if they felt like they were literacy classrooms, they were literacy classrooms. And I think what you'll see is just that the ability to rearrange the room in whatever configuration will best meet the students' needs. And that's the piece that we've been working on each week with Ron and Jack and our team.
You know, the kind of that, I think we used the term pivot from a couple of weeks ago in September, Paul, when you brought this to us, was around the, I think these goals are accurate because they reflect, I think, the shift in our conversation a little bit. Still, though, to John's point, and certainly, and I know that I wrote you about this too, is wanting to have the opportunity to still continue the, with STEAM, and hopefully as the building, we create this flexibility, principals, when they look at their space, can say, now we can use this room over here, which might be, a faculty lounge.
Yeah.
Which I know Churchill struggles with every year. But it could be used for something different because we have the flexibility. Mm-hmm. So not off the table, but just recognizing our problem-based learning, the models that we're using for teaching, have to allow for some nimbleness year on year. And every year, you talk to Scott Klesbitz, for every year he's been principal, that building some part in a different configuration, just based on what the needs have been.
And the number of students.
the grade level configurations, how many students are coming in, and did we have a bubble where we had a large kindergarten class, and how many sections, all of those things. It's just not clean. Mm-hmm. It's not something that I can sit here today and say, I know for a fact that I'm going to be able to use those classrooms for science only. I can't sit up here with a straight face and tell the board that.
So we want classrooms that have the most flexibility. Mm-hmm. That could be used for any number of purposes. And this would provide
for
that.
We believe that's what you're going to see.
Okay, so this is a composite site plan showing the addition in the red circle. I also flag the existing four mobile cluster that's being removed, and then these four mobiles stay. So just for clarification, this is the future as-built condition, and then this is where the stormwater will be located.
So Ron, just looking at that, the question becomes, why did that four-pack stay and why did the other four-pack go? And it's right in the middle of the parking lot, so you would assume that you want to keep the one and not the other. So what's the logic behind that?
And there are a lot of things pulling at this, too. The biggest piece right now is actually site access for construction purposes. So we're studying that. But, in talking with Scott, these are the oldest, and also these are in the construction zone, so they would have to be moved one way or the other. So why move, then demolish, or why? You know, that was the logic. Is that these are the older units, and this is in the construction zone, so they would have to be moved and then reinstalled.
These are the units that we've had some problems with over the past few years. We've actually had to rebuild one of the back walls on a unit back there about 2 or 3 years ago. So these are the oldest portables.
And it is counterintuitive because, we've had several meetings with Scott, and this would open up his parking.
Right.
And he said, no, those are the ones that should go.
Well, sorry. What if you take those out during construction and then you move the newer ones to the back when the construction is completed? Is that been discussed as an option, or is
that
just
going to be in the middle of his hard surface? We have to then push that out. It's certainly doable. We're coming up to an end point, and when we pick it up, we can do whatever you'd like.
Okay.
But that will have a direct.
What happens when those portables are filled out? Then we have the hard space
play area.
Right. Because that's where that got place.
Right.
Because right next to it then is that soft play area with the new equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So we lost all of that.
Right.
Because the other problem there is the only space is during the wintertime is the tar space for the kids to go out on. Everything else is soaking.
Well, but with our new underwater retention, that all may change.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So that may, in effect, open up that whole 41, I'm trying to read it. Whatever the feet back.
Setback?
The whole acreage back there suddenly, or theoretically, opens up. So now we don't need the hard. Right?
I think it's two different functions.
On snow days, kids are still going to be on blacktop surfaces. That's just general rule of thumb. We want our kids, their feet dry, as opposed to going in the afternoon and being soaked. So generally speaking, I've heard, rumor has it, winters are a little different here, and the snow lasts for a little while. I believe they really want to continue to keep that hard surface, as much hard surface, because of our winters.
See, and again, I think it depends on the school. I mean, at our school, when it snowed, the kids went and played in the snow. And they built forts, and they...
When you were in school?
In your school.
No.
at
Ben Franklin. I mean, you bring your boots and, play in the snow and enjoy the snow.
I was going to also give you a quick three-dimensional overview here, too, because this addition is on the same level as the building. If you remember the diamond, you step up. Then this hard surface, we step down. We're down maybe 8 to 10 feet. There's a plateau right here, and then this playground down here is yet on another level down. So we're terracing, and so we're gonna, because of current or
laws regarding ADA. We're going to have to put ramps in to get down there. It's an extensive infrastructure to know. Because we're touching it now, we have to upgrade.
So just one more, not to belabor it, but if we fix the stormwater there, can we then theoretically put a hard surface down there? Like a hard playground?
Yeah. You know, here?
Yes. It's not the whole thing, of course, but just some portion.
Yeah, absolutely. We could add that, and then we just make the system incrementally larger
because
we
have to
detain more. But it would be peanuts in the big scheme of things.
Well, to eliminate that four pack in the middle of the parking lot would seem to be
a target area for later. Right?
Your preference is to remove these.
Yes.
Okay.
And move them down with the other four end.
Well, if we have to, and apparently we do have to, my preference would be to have the parking lot clear and have the in the back.
You know what? At the end of the day, that may be it. We may need to move these mobiles anyway. I mean, if we can't work out a better site construction access point, we may be moving these anyway, and then what you're talking about, we would move them back here. Just, you know, demolish these, move these to the back, and relocate them. So it's all one process.
Okay. But your preference is to open up more parking?
My first preference is where you're at.
Yeah. Okay.
We would love to be able to redo that parking lot, provide more space and better approach and departure areas.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Okay, here's a little bit of an enlarged floor plan. It's very simple. You're going to see the same configuration for the most part repeated at each site. On this particular site, you'll notice the art studio, and we talked about that before. Bob talked about that. There was a question about that. It's currently here. There's a music and an art studio here. Here's the corridor that's cutting through. So instead of making two small classrooms smaller, we made one of the classrooms larger and then recreated that other classroom in the addition. And as Bob said, we do have restroom facilities in this particular addition. So, yes, these arrows are to set up the images in the subsequent pages. So we'll just roll through these and you can cross-reference. Here's a view of the proposed addition area, and that would be from the northeast, looking at the proposed addition. And then this is that same view a little bit closer in to show you the architecture that we're proposing for this addition. And again, the vocabulary is very similar to the existing building, although what we're going to be taking is solid colors from the brick field and then applying those in planes. So it's a simple, modern look. We've also included these vertical window slots that are designed to be windows or doors. So as we continue through the process, we can flip those out. They're interchangeable. That gives you maximum flexibility in the future. This would be swinging around to the southwest, and this is a view from the southwest, looking back, and you can see that the existing gym peeking up there, and in the background, that's the cafeteria, and that's the music room.
So those are the two bathrooms and the...
Correct. That's the bathroom four, and then that's the classroom area.
Why is it, it's the only one of the four buildings that I looked at this that had that kind of set there. I don't know what you would call it, but
that
light.
Window
there? Yeah, more light.
Just to have
more light.
Yes, coming in from the west. And you will actually see that pop up at some of the other buildings, but it's a case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. It's not consistent. Mm-hmm. All right, now this is the image that you that no one has seen. You just finished it about noon. This is actually one of the classroom spaces, and again, very consistent from building to building, so there's no need to render all of these because they're going to be the same pretty much. This is looking at across this teaching station from the northeast again, and looking across towards the outside window. So you can see the actual window slots inside. And we're integrating a detail which is known as a light shelf. And on the outside, we have a sunshade. It's a screen that's going to screen that window so that when you have the intense summer sun, it's going to shade the window. You see that a lot now on buildings. But on the inside, the sunlight actually comes through the window and then bounces off of this white shelf, and you can actually see it puddling on the ceiling. Mm. And if we have light sensors in there, that may actually illuminate that portion of the room or most of the room. So we're going to be harvesting natural daylighting and bouncing it deeper into the space. And we're actually picking up on a lot of the detailing from the Hadley.
with the ceiling planks. These are continuous ceiling planks. And then we have pendant light fixtures that are going to be bouncing up. So it's just a soft indirect lighting in the classroom space.
So you have exit outer doors.
Yes.
Built into that.
Right.
That's an example of that versus just straight windows.
Right. And to go to John's point, you know, if in the future you want to subdivide these even further, you can pull the windows, put doors in, and then you have direct exits. If you wanted to subdivide a classroom, you can do that.
Ron, could you explain to me the difference between a teaching station and a classroom?
That's just a nomenclature. It's one and the same. They're classroom spaces, although it was kind of done in the context of the new curriculum. For instance, art studio, teaching station. So,
classroom.
No, no, correct. Okay. There's no relation.
Did the bathrooms follow the art studio addition or vice versa? Just
why the restrooms?
Make it symmetrical?
If in the long range plan you decide to expand further and permanently house, because remember we set up four, if we permanently house the kids, that this is going to be designed to extend that classroom wing further to the west. And so now you have restrooms located right there in that center wing. So that would be for future provisions. Plus, again, it's a remote spot from the other restroom facilities, so we thought it was appropriate to put those in.
So we have a lack of core. We know we push the limit on core space in all of our buildings. So I'm glad to see that because I think we need it now anyway. For, you know, in addition to maybe looking out to the future.
I mean, given that we would keep 600 whatever kids in each of these buildings, it seems that's our plan. That part of the issue has been facilities to begin with, right? So this is a good thing to have if we're keeping 600, kids in the buildings.
So are these designed to further addition to go out or up or both?
Yeah, if you go back to the site diagram, it would come off in this fashion. Now everything hinges on all of the other spaces in the program and how many integrated resources do you want. So we would have to go back in and do test fits. But we feel, just simple math would tell you that, there's enough room here to replace those with permanent classrooms. But there are other spaces that are still missing. And what if you go to full day, kindergarten, et cetera, which are going to have to be determined. It's designed to receive that.
And we're not doing that now because of the limitations that we have financially.
Correct.
And would it make a difference, your future build is out and back? How about up? What does that do to the cost in terms of thinking that you'd go up next time?
Well, there's a practical restriction with going up. We can do it, and I have done it before, too, designed entire wings to have second floors, but your school is down for that 9 or 10 months. So as a practical matter down the line, when you build vertically, you can't use the classrooms below. And you have to relocate those kids. So
just bring the portables back in for 8 months.
But from a cost perspective, though,
I assume you're laying a different type of foundation. Is it a significant difference in cost to plan that way as opposed to how?
The other problem is the roof structure is more costly than the foundation situation because now you're creating a floor versus the roof.
There is a premium, right.
Right, and then you have to decorate an elevator, which is a space for handicapping up and down. Mm-hmm. Staircases take up space.
But, John, we actually did a test fit for a two-story wing over there. Depending on what happens with the diamond and future parking, we did test fits with a two-story wing, so we would put a two-story wing next to that to maximize the vertical space.
This,
we did that in the future.
This recommendation here provides for a story and a half because the ceilings are going to be up to 14 feet high. What we talked about throughout this process is that we may put it, if we were going to go beyond this initial building, put a two-story addition just to the west of this current recommended addition. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately, we've talked about taking down that diamond-shaped area in the front of the building and reconfiguring the parking and approach and departure and everything else. That's long-term.
Now, I'm taking a lot of time. Do you want more information? Because I can give you a couple more details if you'd like.
Sure.
Okay.
Unless anybody's tired. We need take a break.
Okay. Go back one more slide because you know we just had this is hot off the press. Go back to the site plan, site diagram. Because we had talked about the drain pipes, you know, installing the drain pipes. We would also design it, the manifold system back there to receive future pipes for that future expansion. So we wouldn't be, you know, we wouldn't be providing for a future capacity, but we'd be designing to receive future capacity, if that makes sense. So we're anticipating all that.
So is green space an issue at Churchill? I don't know. Is it?
It's come up under any MFP meeting that we've had. It's been the press for additional green space, and especially well at the back of all our buildings, Lincoln, Churchill.
So let's just talk about Churchill. Churchill's a green space issue, but our strategy seems to be build this on, and then later on, we could build again on just taking more green space.
That's not green space that it's taken from.
But I don't think it's a strategy, is it? I mean, it's just when you're building today, make sure you give yourself the most flexibility for the future. It's not saying our long-range plan is to build a two-story building on the back. It's just saying, hey, you're out here doing this construction. While you're doing it, give us the most flexibility you can give us. That's why we're doing underground storage.
I've heard the plan is to have this so that we can enable another four pack, you know, back there.
I think it was flexibility in your end construction so you could do it if that was something the board decided in, or some other board decided in the future. But when we made this pivot, I think phase two did not include that. And we included something totally different. So,
but phase two wouldn't allow us to go up on what you put down there without in the red there, phase two.
That's correct. We're not building in provisions for a second floor because that would be 2.5 stories, maybe 3 tall.
So the plan would either take more green space or wipe out a wing and make it 2 stories.
Do that? Come back? Yes. Right. Any number.
But that's why I think Scott is saying we want to remove these because it opens up the space. Even on the image, this photo, you can see how the portable backs up on their blacktop, which is really where the kids play, in addition to that kind of recessed play space. So I can see where Scott wants to just clear that space out of any classroom building.
The portable there, Erica, is the one that goes, is that what you're saying?
Yes. And it is the one that, I mean, was probably when my son was there, but we had to do some work on it.
Let's go to the other interior photo. One more. This is looking back towards the door of one of the teaching stations. See it right down here? And I know this is awfully light, but we actually have picked up on the color scheme. It's kind of a light blue and a sandy color. This reflects the color scheme that is repeating the colors that are in the school. Mm-hmm. It's subtle, but it's there.
Now, would you show where the retractable wall would be going?
Right, this is the operable wall panel right here. Mm-hmm. It's pocketed, and that can come out to create the classroom space. The individual teaching station, it's that wall right there. Mm-hmm. It's right there, and there's an overhead track.
There's water sinks on both sides.
Yeah, you can see the faucet there. These will all be mobile cabinets. The sink bases and the wall cabinets are fixed, but we wanted to give the teacher maximum flexibility. And you can see there's a marker board over here. This is considered the teaching wall for the teacher, but we built in provisions so that we could put marker boards here. We'll put data drops in there too so that they can teach against that wall. So again, maximum.
I'm sorry, so that view is one teaching station, or is that two
teaching stations? With the wall open.
Okay,
the wall
right. Is open. So you've given one side of the room a teaching board, but the other side of the room not a teaching board?
It's just on this wall.
It's on the other side.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
It's
okay.
A mirror image.
Okay.
You see one configuration of furniture, one classroom, and the other configuration in the other classroom.
All right, I just...
And the sinks are on both sides.
Correct. Correct.
Have you guys seen that paint that now you can just write on? It's like a
That's what we put it down. We have the whole wall, the JIP wall. These are hybrid black. It won't necessarily work on that, but we could skin this with gypsum, and then you can have that writing surface. Yes.
I don't know if you're seeing more and more of that at schools.
Yeah.
And maybe we use that on these walls near the sink for the student section.
Sure.
Because we see a lot of students breaking up, using the board, using the wall to
affect their learning. It's got to be space that doesn't have a...
Remember those cabinets?
The cabinets are on
wheels. Those cabinets move.
Oh, they move.
Again, the whole thing, the whole concept is flexibility. Mm-hmm. And what Ron has been able to do is really embody that within this. So the cabinets move, the walls move, the furniture is that current 21st century furniture we have in many of in all of our schools.
The roof retracts.
The roof, yeah. Everything.
No, it's very
interesting. That's your $500.
The doors. There would be an opportunity that he'll be showing you a little bit later for outdoor teaching spaces.
One other detail before we move into the hallway. These are punched openings that go into the corridor to actually add some natural daylighting into the corridor from the classroom. But we've designed skylights in the corridor on the corridor side so that there actually would be a backflow of natural daylighting coming from the other direction. So we're still studying it, and we may add more windows, and we may modify that, but this is a work in progress. Now, here's that corridor, and this is actually standing in approximately in the existing building looking down to the west. And you can see here's where the ceiling drops down at the restrooms and the music room. But this is a, we're studying this. This is a model. It was just finished today. So we're going to study the ceiling height, but you can see these alcoves for the skylights. And you can see these are the classroom windows.
So the existing property is, you were saying, like cascading? Or
yes.
So are we grading up to...
Yeah, we're going to be building up that pad.
Okay.
And my numbers, I added quite a few cubic yards of fill, cut and fill, as an allowance. Everything that I put in there are allowances because there was no design. So now they're going to be digging into that, no pun intended, to give us better information.
Well, this is also an area where, depending on what the soil tests tell us and what the permitting process tells us, this is a... Churchill's a great location for moving fill to from other sites.
And our other sites will have fill and excess fill?
Yeah.
Well, especially Forest Glen, where we're putting the tanks in.
Yep.
So
Lincoln's going to have it too because those buildings are set in all of it. Yeah.
So we'll be able to reuse the fill that normally, theoretically.
In the best case scenario, you'll be able to fill your own site.
So you're going to balance off four sites.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
The only thing is you're doing two different summers.
Yeah.
We need to stockpile.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So it's not an ideal situation, but it's a possibility.
And what's the purpose of the 14 feet? Is it to get more light in? Is that because that just seems that the higher it is, the more noise you get in the room.
No, I think Bob said 14 feet. We're going to play with that dimension. We're going to study it with the door closed and see what that is. That's a comfortable height. It's comfortable. It's going to feel airy. The classrooms are going to feel much larger. I mean, if you actually have the ability to do a similar detail at Franklin, but you have a Lincoln ceiling blocking that plaster ceiling that's above, you know, the old 1920s ceiling. So it's going to feel larger, even though it's approximately the same size as most of the other rooms. All right, so here we are at Forest Glen. Again, the same identifiers. This is the area of construction over here in the west, and then the mobiles are going to be pushed, relocated off to the north and to the west temporarily until construction is complete. So,
and then they'll be gone.
Correct.
And the reason for that is this wouldn't get done over a summer period.
They're in the way of the new construction.
That's correct.
We're in the construction area.
That's correct. How long those have to stay, we're still trying to dig into that. We can't move them until school is out, so we can't start until June. And they have to be up and running by August 15th or so, 2.5 months. It's just not...
So the issue there is simply they're on the space we need.
Yeah. Yep.
It's kind of the old build a new stadium on the parking lot. Correct that, right?
Yep. Yeah.
And similarly here, is there a green space issue at Forest Glen?
You know what? I think you're now adding permanent space. I mean, as a practical matter, this is where the mobiles are. These are where the mobiles are now. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be similar.
Let's go back a step. If Churchill and Forest Glen are 2 summers away,
correct.
Why don't we move the portables a year earlier? Move them to your designated zone. Then you can have that construction area as you described before.
Versus
an April start.
Good.
So then the only thing is you have major construction going on in April adjacent to the classroom. So you have to make special.
But you're going to have major construction going on either before or after.
Inside work versus outside work. Outside work is a little longer.
So are you saying, I'm not tracking with this, so move the portable in.
For next year.
Forest Glen. Move the portable.
After school's out.
After school's out.
That's all I need to hear. Yeah. And, can't hear that part. Okay.
Because then the next spring you could start. You're not moving the students. Well, just a
good point. So is there any reason that we couldn't do that?
Maybe just logistics from the distance from the building to where you would place them. Safety, security,
cover canopy. Yeah, I mean, if the kids, because right now the kids come in through there, so they couldn't take that path, they'd have to go around.
You're going to have it from August to December anyways.
That's a minor inconvenience.
So it's on the wheel track, Ron?
Yes, absolutely. We also talked about, which is why we want to keep the stormwater design and permitting process going for all 4 sites. We also talked about that very issue with the balancing. This all ties together. It's moving ahead with your stormwater. If we keep everything bolted in place, the addition doesn't go, but we clean up the site down here. Design it now, permit it now, and get your stormwater, and then take that fill and use it over to Churchill. Okay. And just to give you one more point of reference, this is about the same size as the field over the underground field over at Franklin as a placeholder. All right, here we are with the image targets again. 1 is an existing photo, 2 will be a rendering, and 3 will be another rendering. Existing conditions, there's your mobiles. Proposed, again, here's the, this is actually the storage room addition in the back, but you can see the architecture very similar to the other ones. The brick mix is almost the same. And we do have, you'll see these on each site too. We have equipment screens around the air handling systems. These are all ducted systems. They're not unit vents. They're going to be, and it's going to be very similar to the Hadley addition that we would use the ARI ducts.
So those floor units won't.
Correct.
Have
There's
to
no
do
noisy. It's a duct. They drop down. It's a ducted heating and cooling system. And then here would be a view from the northwest. Looking back, and there's the existing building. All right, now here's...
And I'm sorry, just got asked a question on each one of those. But on that one, there's no way to go up either, right? With the current structure? Or is there, and this is that significantly more?
With the existing building?
Yeah. No, with the with the addition, right? I didn't want to...
Both of them. On this addition, could I go up later? Although I don't think you ever have to.
You're
not designed for Forest Glen at this point. But could you go up on any other 4 classrooms?
The other existing
now?
Buildings?
Yeah.
Or the existing building itself?
Yeah.
The existing building itself is not designed for Forest Glen.
Okay. Right.
Does this
eliminate
the portables
at Forest Glen? Okay. That's why I think on this one you have to worry about going up on the on the new structure, because it seems like adding another 4-pack later, then you really fill the green space at that school.
Classic design too.
Yeah, I don't think that you have another strategy here. Like at Churchill, if you want to add more green space here, I don't think you've got that as a strategy.
It's never been a conversation for this building, putting on more than just this addition. Churchill and Franklin have always been considered for further expansion.
Right.
We're also tracking, and this is a new item from maybe yesterday morning, no, last week, but we're tracking an outdoor classroom space here on the north portion of the lawn so that the entire building can use it, but it's going to be adjacent to the addition. Right, here's Franklin. And this is
we still provide four classrooms, but the design deviates from the four pack. Sort of offset bars. So let's go, and this is where the mobiles are currently, and we'll be eliminating all mobiles here ultimately. And of course, here's where the addition goes. So we have five images here showing the addition because we do have these, we're calling them courtyards, they're really outdoor learning spaces. And you'll see that in a minute in the rendering. But then again, here's the addition. We are expanding the paving over here so that we can get service vehicles to the back of the site. And we are also anticipating additional paving here off to the west. So we're going to be converting green space to hard surface. The Cook really needs that space. So one of the things that would be on the bubble is you can see that we're in within the theoretical setback zone, so we may have to give that away. You already do have paving that's in there. Well, you don't want to see that.
And it's for the kids there in the winter or for parkways?
Playground. It's hard surface.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You have definitely a terrain situation at this school. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's move around the images. Again, this is an existing shot from the southwest. This is moving a little bit to the north. This is the proposed addition. Looks like it's a nighttime shot. The sun's going down. It's not by design. But you can see that, again, we're playing on the same vocabulary that we played at the other sites, which is to pick up on a single brick color and then repeat that in a flat plane. The window configurations will be the same as the other buildings. This particular site, we have a stairway here that goes down and then heads over towards the main office area. This is all on the same level as the main office. There's no up or down. There's no interior ramps to get to this addition. We're building it into the hillside. This is going to be the trash enclosure right here that's currently up against the building. We're just moving it back and out. I know there's been discussion about that. Why? But this is the most practical location. We did study other locations, but there's really still no good answer there because that garbage truck has this is your service drive.
Yeah.
So it's the back end, the front of the building. There you go. This is looking at the addition from the southeast, and you can see these are guardrails that are going to be going along this retaining wall that's going to create a flat surface adjacent to the classroom, so that the classrooms will all have full height windows, doors to the outside, and you'll see that in a minute. There it is. Yeah, this is the outdoor learning space. Again, the slide's a little darker than
storm's moving in.
Yeah. But we are we studied all sorts of different planner details, and we are going to have some plants down there to have some green space, but this is going to be again, used as a pull-up space when weather permits for the kids. There is a stairway over here going to the playground, but when you exit off to the east, you're at grade. You're going to ramp down. You never go out the stairs. It's all going to be flat behind the retaining wall.
How does that align with ADA requirements?
That meets ADA.
That's okay.
Right, right.
Because I wondered on this drawing, my question was, how do we get people to know that?
Well, but this is fully accessible, this particular area, because you do have access from the classroom, which is all at the main level, and you do have outside areas here. Now, on the other side, that is a contained courtyard. There's a stairway out, so the accessible entry is from the classroom, but it's all fully accessible.
So what about the safety concern? How high is that fence?
That could be 4.5-5 feet. We had a lot of discussions on that. This is, I want to say, 6 to 7 feet down, 6 to 8 feet down. So it's a light well, and we had a lot of discussions on that. We don't feel like it's a hazard, but that's our opinion. And this is a common detail. You have this detail already over there. Mm-hmm. This is not new. You have stairwells down to the gym that already exist.
Yeah, I guess I know that the stairway up there, I think you said into the entrance or something, I know that has caused problems of icing and, people getting hurt. I don't know if that can be covered or not. The
new staircase is covered. Right, there are interior stairs that the fire exits are all covered. This is really a communicating stair right here.
Yeah. So they, it should
just
be
keep that in mind. That's been an issue in the building.
Right. Yeah, because that's, I think he said, we have grading issues. That whole Ben Franklin tilts to the east, right?
Yeah.
So to me, in a heavy rain and snowmelt, that turns into a man-made riverbed. Because it's all going to come from that blacktop in that play area.
Yeah, that's no, no, that will flow around it.
That grading will actually go to your underground retention.
Right.
Okay.
So everything up of that view is going to go to the south and then to that underground retention.
Okay.
No water will sheet through the air. All right, that's a view, a shot of that north outdoor classroom. It's the same width, it's a little bit deeper, but it's going to function in the same manner. It's a north exposure, so we're not going to have that lighting, but we wanted to give the natural daylighting capability to those classrooms.
Back to that other picture. Well, that one more. How is that water going to, is it just going to be a slight grade where it's in there, in that area, because there'll just be a slight grade into what you said, the front entrance, so it'll move out.
Walk out to the front.
Yeah, the hope is that we can come in, again, nothing's been engineered yet. This is our schematic. But the hope is that you can start here and pitch away towards that wall.
And then out to the south.
Now, it'll be captured and channeled, but if it does back up, it can overflow to the east.
Okay. But we'll not have to, isn't the retention there further south?
Yes. Yeah, the large basin is directly south here, directly south.
So I'll have to connect through that underneath the parking lot?
Yeah, they'll go across the easement to tie into that basin.
And that's factored in the cost here? As
for now. It's a work in progress, that's right. But that's where we're at right now.
Precisely.
All right, here we go with Lincoln. Again, the same rule of thumb. This is the area of new construction up here in the far west. And then here are where the mobiles are being relocated, from the west to the north. And maybe a little bit more detail on that. There is a topography issue here, so these mobiles will have to be split and terraced going up there to get all four of those in. That's where we're at today. That's our solution. So we'll continue to study that and work with the mobile installers to sort that out. Okay, here are the proposed additions. And again, they're split so that we can maintain natural daylighting to these interior classrooms. But again, it's four teaching stations, a very simple concept. What's not shown here and what did pop up over the last week is the outdoor classroom space. We will be budgeting for an outdoor classroom in that area.
And detention.
That's right. And yes, that's where we're proposing for the underground stormwater detention to be located. And then it's either going to release to the south or it's going to release to the west to Newton. And there's an existing sanitary line down here too, and we're hoping to tie this into a sanitary that's already in the block. All right, here's an existing image of looking at the site from the northwest of the existing school, and there's your award-winning mobiles.
And you see those mobiles are up high, too.
Right.
So grade will be cut down through the classrooms.
So I spun around, and now I'm looking at these proposed additions from the southwest. This would be standing on just about Newton, looking in that direction. And again, you can see the flat planes, the window details are the same. You can see we've added some four-story windows, so there are slight variations with windows across the site. And then finally, this is actually a rendering slash photo. We call it a photo montage. But you can see the addition superimposed on the existing photograph. And we're doing this to show the context of the impact, because for the most part, this is where the mobile classrooms are now.
So if you went two stories there, because again, the strategy here is take more green space if we need to take the other four, that'd probably be kind of hideous because you're so close to the street.
Well, yeah, I think you get pushback from a design standpoint, but that you're going, you know, two stories are only appropriate when you have efficiencies of volume, because you're going to have stairs in there and elevators, and so as a practical matter, a second floor over two classrooms is just not practical. It's an inefficient solution. It can be done.
Yeah. No, I agree with that.
And Lincoln was, the entire design was much more aggressive at one point, and
so
the reason we're scaling it back is because of the cost associated to
it. The television area,
that whole interior.
Right, the center office. Because yeah. At one point there was, let's blow that out and do more to that.
That was with the original STEAM concept, mm-hmm. and our target was STEAM labs at the time. And so when we pulled back and focused on the classroom space, this made all sense in the world. To do this, because those classrooms, to do all of that work in the inside of the building didn't make sense from a classroom standpoint, because that wasn't our goal programmatically. So we kind of gravitated away from that and into this configuration. And we actually studied, additional classroom bars and tying this all together, but then we started crossing over into the setback, which required variances, and it was a big can of worms. So we settled on this one, which is a very good solution.
Any other questions?
Look forward to seeing them. I do have a question from a question. There's estimates in the cap grade, 6%. Cap grade, lab grade. I'm just curious if your estimates, how did you get to the penny?
Well, that's what the computer spits out.
Okay.
Not my design.
Yeah. Oh, quite accurate.
If we hit it to the penny.
Yeah, I'm very impressed. Yeah. Any other questions for any of them? Ron, Bob, Jack, Fred?
Very good to meet you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for being here tonight.
Great, thanks, and we'll see you again very soon, I'm sure.
Every board meeting. All right.
Okay, moving on.
So we are now moving into our final presentation this evening, as part of this packet, that is the introduction to the financial section. Just basically providing the board with a little background in terms of what estimated costs are for the project, what our very initial recommendation may be for the use of fund balances and a particular funding mechanism, and then just to give you a little idea in terms of where we stand. The second page of that section there lays out the assumptions that were used in preparing the long-range financial plan, and that is a 10-year financial plan. In all honesty, that's like trying to see from the crystal ball how to manage a couple of years in the school district. But I was asked to prepare that to present it, and that's what we're doing this evening. Like I said, on the second page of that section, it has the revenue and in the beginning and end of the salary, the revenue expenditure expectations or assumptions. If you'd like, I'm more than happy to walk through those individually. If you have any questions on them, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions on, or should we let Bob?
Let's go that approach, the questions.
Okay.
You know, one thing I'd like to ask that came up here in discussion was if we could put, just so we see it, the portable savings that we're going to have when this is complete, we can project that out per year on one of your line items on the bottom.
I can identify that as a separate line item just so we track it. Yeah, eventually it'll bite.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
If we do that, then we're going to have to put the incremental cost increases of the bond payment. The bond.
They're in there. That is with the. What is that?
With MBs.
With MBs payments.
With, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, those are the new bonds.
Yes. Those are the new
ones. We'll walk through that page
okay.
a little bit for you. Because those.
I see you also building the possible pension reform.
Yes.
I was just asked to do that to provide for some unknowns and to also show that we still have some flexibility in future years should we be forced, certain obligations may be forced on us. You know, let me just back up for a second. There are two pages of spreadsheets here. The first page shows current budgeting expectations. If nothing were to change, if we were just move forward and roll with the current plan. The second page includes expenditures for the capital. If you'll notice down at the bottom there, lower left-hand side, Patrick, it says capital building plan borrowing cost. That's the estimated borrowing cost annually over the next 10 years, and that takes into account the NB financial plan because that was the cheapest overall plan at this point in time. May change, but that's the one. That's the item that I used when preparing these.
So that assumes the $7 million.
Yeah. Right.
Yes. We used that. We went to a $14 million hard cost, and that's why we wanted to look, give the board an opportunity to look at is $7 million in.
So that was $7 million 10 years.
$7 million 15 years.
$7 million 15 years.
15 from 2015 to
2024.
No,
well,
that's
no,
okay. But
it's. It's a
10-year financial, plan.
So 10 out of 15.
Correct. And it appears that we have sustainability for a number of years out, at least 10 years that we've been able to take a look at.
So are we committing that we would not, I don't want to say commit, but are we suggesting here with these, with the zeroed out bond payments, sorry,
which page are you on, John?
I'm on the
first
10-year.
These are the spreadsheets.
The 10-year, the second spreadsheet. We have current bond payments of, take 2013, $2.7 million, right?
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
And then next year, $2.8
million?
Uh-huh. So are we suggesting that when those bonds retire, we will not replace those with anything else at this point?
That's what the assumptions are. I've reduced the revenue as well as the expenditure line items because we won't be levying nor expending for a levy, for debt service.
Okay. And
any other questions?
So yeah, percent for salary, that takes into account the, our new contract and how we're
that is correct.
So that
correct.
Average.
It is an average.
It's in the it's in the write-up that precedes the spreadsheets.
Yeah, I guess I have to think through that assumption because at some point, I don't know. I mean, at some point, would we issue other bonds?
That would be a referendum issue.
It would be a referendum issue.
Mm-hmm.
So
we did not feel comfortable putting that here. That would be a huge assumption on staff's part.
Well, that would imply to me then that there's no plan for a referendum for a new school to deal with the other portables. Or
we just felt like we weren't at that point to be putting that on paper to say that the staff is assuming that we know exactly where the board's at on this. And we have not had enough conversation with board mm-hmm. for Bob and I to be putting that type of number on this document. We've had limited to no conversation on referendum. Mm-hmm. It is in that plan, that three-phase plan.
Mm-hmm.
However, the board has had
detail.
Yes.
And
so
it's going to be more than one number. It's on the revenue side.
Absolutely.
It's on the
correct.
Side.
It was that we had the conversation. It was a conscious decision to leave it out because of exactly what I talked about.
The net is a zero effect.
I think. You know, we've heard numbers, I don't know, $20 million, $30 million for a new school.
Mm.
It'd be interesting to see what this looks like based on that and, you know, to even see if it's sustainable.
Well, just to give you an example, we went out for referendum back X number of years ago.
99, right?
And we had a $40 million bond referendum. And the financing for that round dollars was about $3 million annually. What you levy, you'll expend out through the debt service fund. So there's zero net effect to the bottom line.
Yeah.
In the year 2018-19, we'll be making our last payments in 17-18. So in 18-19, you'll notice that I reduced the revenue expectations or projections off of property taxes. That takes out the levy from that year on through the balance of this financial plan.
How did you reduce the property taxes?
Well, you're not going to levy in the debt service fund.
Right, yes. But you are. So that's why you went from 48 to 46?
That's correct, along with an assumption of 2.5% growth and so forth. That's the net effect of all the changes.
Right, so that's a 1 year.
It continues.
No, there's
no longer that levy. I mean, right, if you pass a referendum, you're going to have a new levy, which is going to increase your revenues. And what Bob's saying, it's a net zero. You then find it on your expenses. So, in fact, the budget you have in front of you, you just put in numbers for your $30 million referendum.
Because it doesn't...
It's the bottom is the same number.
It doesn't impact our us pay. It's not like a certificate bond.
Not for
where we're paying out of general operating funds to pay for the bond. That's the biggest difference. And that's the most important difference.
We're not levying for these capital bonds. I get that.
I mean, it impacts the tax bill. Okay. All
right. Right. So the budget should hold for either case. The net number holds for either case.
Those were my assumptions in preparing this plan.
Okay.
So that is it for this evening's presentation. If you have any questions, give me a call or an email. I'd be happy to answer them.
Any other questions for us on the presentation on the facility side of the house?
So is this
we've cleared the room?
almost.
What's the plan before? We're going to get the cost estimates for the
October 28th. You will have from Jack and FQC.
Yes.
You want to detail that a little bit more for them?
So everything that you've seen up to this point has been FGM's estimation on a cost per square footage basis of everything that they've been looking at from a programming standpoint. What we're trying to do is we're trying to build an actual spreadsheet that breaks the building down into the way we think about a building going together, from demolition, excavation, concrete, steel, lighting, roofing, and building it based on what we can see in schematic level drawings. We don't know exactly what kind of light fixtures, we don't know exactly what kind of flooring, we don't know exactly what kind of casework. But through our experience and their experience informing us, we can bracket our thinking around what makes sense logically in our spreadsheet. So we're gonna give a level of detail to the schematic design that's just significantly more advanced than what you've seen up to this point with regard to the building. We got more information from Erickson Engineering on Friday. They met with the village today. So we're gonna rely on Erickson Engineering and their professional opinion with regard to a lot of the site development costs, based on their experience and what they're hearing and what they're engineering. So it's going to be a blend of an engineering estimate and a construction estimate on the site work as it relates to stormwater. The building portion of it is going to be much more detailed, but we'll still call it an SD estimate. But it's not going to be based on cost per square foot for 5,000 square feet of building. It's going to be based on how much steel, how much concrete, how much block, how many windows, how many doors, how much technology. So it's going to be an informed estimate. But it's an SD estimate, so we'll still have a 10% contingency on it. And that's what we'll give to you for your 28 forward package.
And that number is a tighter number where we would be saying, you know, I'm not saying we're going with MB mm-hmm. Financial or yeah. William Blair. That's the bond amount that we want to do.
That would help drive your next conversation. How do you want to? Do you want to use full? That's the best way of saying it. You want to use your fund balance for the entire thing if the costs come into that range, or do you want to split some of your costs? It's exactly what you said, Patrick.
Correct. Yeah, we're not going to give you a range.
We're going to give
you what we think the number is going to be. Now it's going to have a contingency in it, so the number is we're going to be conservative. It's going to be on the higher end from our perspective. It's everything you've gotten today has integrity to it, but that's not our benchmark. Our benchmark is what we think it's going to take to build a building.
And that's your role.
Right. Or you.
Yep.
Any other questions?
Yeah, back to the debt certificate. So mm-hmm. the debt certificate is going to come out of the general operating expense. In the previous discussions, we talked that there would be some sacrifices made to fund it out of that. Is this spreadsheet that you have here basically saying there's no need to worry about what we would cut from our general operating to fund this because it's only $300,000-$400,000 a year?
Yeah, I'm suggesting there are no cuts.
Because, do you want to talk a little bit
because it's
the rationale behind it, where what you and Lori...
Yeah.
currently we have 35 teachers that have declared their intention to retire. Mm-hmm. Jorge and I sat down last week and did an analysis, and we have 59 teachers that are beyond the 32 that have already declared their intent that we would say would be in the pipeline over the next 10, 12, 15 years. And those savings, based upon what they will probably retire at and what we would ordinarily hire at, provide for some substantial sustainability, long-range financial sustainability for a number of years, because you're talking a quarter of your staff overall retiring in the next 10, 15 years. So that's what's baked into my projections beyond the initial 4 or 5 years, like triggering additional calculations around 17, 18, because we know the teachers that are already have declared. And, you know, that could even become greater. We looked at the spread in age of some of our staff, and the ones that are more senior in age may actually decide to declare and just go out in a year or two. So there's additional savings beyond this.
You are very conservative.
I was very conservative,
very conservative
in my projections. And
you had replacement costs and ongoing salary increases that we've projected.
And, you know, Sam and I, Erica were on the initial, or not on the initial, but the GIA negotiations a couple of years ago. And one of the things that we talked about were estimated savings over a number of years in terms of announced or projected retirees. And we gave them a number of somewhere around $3 million over the next 4 or 5 years, what those estimated savings would be, just based upon the number of known retirees.
So you're basically saying a $7 million debt certificate will have no impact on our general operating, our ability to pay that out of our general operating budget, based on teacher retirements.
Correct.
And no major changes in local, state, or federal funding, and the assumptions that we've built into these projections.
I mean, the only thing that would, to make that super conservative, would be to assume full-day kindergarten, but that's not a...
And we looked,
we looked at
full-day kindergarten, lengthening the school day. We looked at possible pension reform.
So that's all embedded in these numbers?
No.
The pension is,
but full-day...
Full-day, we know the cost.
And longer day is nothing.
No. We've identified the potential for that cost. Mm-hmm. We just haven't been
in the spreadsheet. Okay.
I just want to be careful that those assumptions. That's saying going full debt financing on this.
No, 7.9%. Just 7.9%.
7.9% debt. Whatever his number is going to be that he comes with.
50%. Yeah, but the analysis
it's
is
50%. 50% from the fund.
And that's all we did was split it.
Yeah.
That is your decision as to how you do it.
And then we rationalize it. Bob, we appreciate the numbers, but we rationalize it saying we're going to do it on the delta of the new teacher, an old versus old teacher. I'm not comfortable with that right now. I'd rather say this is how much it's going to cost, and if there's savings or costs, salary differentials that are added, I would rather go, okay, then let's fund a 70-30 split.
That is...
We're going to look at that.
Yeah.
This is not intended as a recommendation or anything else.
Okay.
All these numbers will continue to shake out over the next 2 to 4 weeks. And
this is just how he got to his numbers.
Yes.
Right. This was all about a presentation and your opportunity to ask questions this evening.
Yeah.
Because I think, and just for clarity, for the 39, I think you said, that have declared...
32, 33.
Whatever, the 30-something that declared, that's something, I guess you... Is it fair to say you can take that to the bank? Because they declared...
Well, once they declare, then there's a clock that starts.
So that one is firmer in terms of risk than the other 12 or 14.
I would just say then the money that's saved, we just, instead of a 50-50 split, we go to a 60-40 mm-hmm. or 70-30.
And we could certainly have those conversations.
Yes.
Anything else?
So much, Bob.
Any other questions?
Okay. We appreciate the entire staff, FGM, FQC. It really has been a team effort these last few weeks, and for Bob, and everyone else. They've been working on a daily basis, so I really appreciate everyone's thinking input to bring it to you guys tonight, so you're able to think about this very differently as we come forward next week with some harder numbers and continuing those conversations into November.
Okay. It's 9:13. I would suggest a 5-minute break, and then we can get right back into the next agenda item. Any objection to that? Okay. We'll be back at 9:18.
Yeah.
All right. It's 9:18. The next item on the agenda is action items. Consent agenda. Are there any items board members would like removed from the consent agenda to be considered separately? Hearing none, may I have a motion to approve the reports and recommendations contained in the consent agenda, which include the Human Resources Personnel Report, including employment recommendations and internal transfers, other matters, including approval of board meeting minutes, the September 23rd, 2013 regular board meeting, the September 23rd, 2013 Board of Education regular meeting closed session, and the September 18th, 2013 special meeting of the consortium of local school districts. May I have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Motion. Second.
Motion by Mr. Pachinski, second by Mr. Ellis. I will say at this point that the September 23rd, let me first say I'm a little disappointed in all of you because in the September 23rd regular board meeting minutes, I was included as voting yes to superintendent's recommendations and something else, which was clearly a typo, but you all failed your test.
I so would also like to add that the minutes reflected that tonight's meeting was going to be at 7:30.
Well, okay. Well, I guess we need to correct. We might need to correct those minutes.
When the regular board meeting for tonight, was it posted for 6 or 7:30?
It was posted for 6.
In the minutes. I get what you're saying.
So in any event, we've had
both of you guys picked that up.
we need a roll call at this point.
Sorry. Mr. Kenwood.
Yes.
Mr. Pachinski.
Yes.
Mrs. Nelson.
Yes.
Mr. Ellis.
Yes.
Mr. Escalante.
Yes.
Mr. Black.
Yes, and I'm looking through the minutes that I have in front of me, and it says the October 15th regular meeting, 7 p.m. So we'll make that.
I don't recall when we changed the time.
Could have been after the meeting. Could have been after the meeting, so this could be valid anyway.
Yeah, okay. But we're looking for it.
Okay. Superintendent's recommendations.
Not that I read.
At its September 23rd, 2013 meeting, the board discussed the following recommendations. One, FGM contract renewal, the Amendment 24 through Amendment 28, professional services agreement, to approve the amendments to the contract with District Architect of Record, FGM Architects. The amendments cover the work expected of FGM over the course of the 2013-14 fiscal year, such as that related to the additions under discussion by the board, upcoming roof work, and other matters, i.e. portable inspections, fees, professional services, etc. May I have a motion to approve the administration's recommendation as presented?
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Mrs. Nelson, second by Mr. Pachinski. Discussion.
I have a discussion on Amendment 25. I just needed to understand, and I don't think I do, are we approving $900,000 compensation for FGM around roof replacement just for the design, the bidding, and the contracting?
No. What you're doing is Amendment 25 says that we will do approximately $900,000 worth of roof work, including the compensation to be paid to the architects. That's on page 105 for Amendment 25. Amount of the owner's overall budget for the project, including the architectural compensation, is $900,000.
Okay, so when it says total projected cost of the project are estimated $900,000, do we have a, and maybe I read all these wrong, but is there a cost associated with that for Amendment 25 for FGM?
not specifically. I've told them to plan on doing approximately $750,000 worth of roofing work for next year. That the difference between the $900,000 and the $750,000 would be their approximate fees associated with that recommendation. Now, one of the things to remember here is that we're obligated to do some roofing work at Lincoln next year because we received that $50,000 grant last year. So we're looking to do probably, you know, if it's $750,000, probably $150,000 worth of roofing work at Lincoln, the balance to be completed. And that hasn't been determined yet, but we're leaning towards Hadley right now.
So I guess, sorry, but I just need, so we're thinking that we would pay them $150,000 to help them, to have them help us in the design of the roof. We're just replacing roofs, right?
They would design the roof. It would be a complete replacement of the roof. Those are 20-plus-year-old roofs. We were going through it today, and the warranties expired. We've already 10 years beyond our initial expiration of the warranties. And what they do, they've done roofing work for just like parking lots, is they design and bid those projects for us.
So, John, it might help you that it's on page 25 of the board packet. We're under 1.5, says compensation for this particular amendment. It says it shall be 8% of the cost of the work. So I think Bob is saying that the cost of the work could be $900, or it could be $750, but whatever the number is, it's 8% of that number.
That's correct.
So, okay, because I calculated 15% based on the numbers you just threw out. But
based on what?
Well, if it's $750.
Oh, yeah, and I was using broad numbers, and that's how I asked them to prepare their contract. They'll bill according to what the construction cost is.
So basically, are you saying this then, that for amendments 24 through 28, the budget is $400,000?
That's what we projected earlier this year.
For them?
For them, as well as we talked about construction manager work, and then soil borings and any other work associated with the recommendation for additions. Now, because we're increasing the scale of next year's work, there's going to be some additional cost incurred. As we're going through this evening's presentation, we're going to need to sit down and take a look at that and determine exactly what those fees are going to entail. And we'll be providing the board with an update a little further along in the year. Now we're talking about ramping up Lincoln and bringing that in next year. Obviously, there'll be some increased costs associated with construction manager fees, architectural fees, professional fees, and so forth.
Some amendments are just flat fee, for lack of a better term, and some are percentage-based.
Yeah. A roofing analysis and a portable inspection that we do annually, those are just flat fees. Everything else is based upon the actual construction cost of the project that they design and bid.
Can I go off track just once? Because what you're talking about is the soft cost of the overall budget that we're looking at on the presentation today. And you said that our soft cost, and this everybody's on the same page with this, they're built into our budget already.
Correct? That's correct.
And that's what we're approving right here, those soft costs. So when you see those big numbers in Bob's budget or the architect's budget, it has the hard cost, which is what we're looking at our funding, and then it has a soft cost number, and it has a total. I get nervous that people are focused on the total and not knowing where the funding of the soft cost is coming from. It's already in the planned budget, and this is an example of it.
I didn't follow your last statement. Could you get concerned when?
When we're talking about it, I get concerned that people get lost and get focused on how are you going to fund $20 million, because that's what the total budget may be if you include hard costs and soft costs. Do you understand that or no?
Yeah, I see what you're saying, because we do talk about, we go to the large number. When you provide these updates for us, the superintendent recommendation, anytime you've brought this to us, it's been to confirm or affirm that one-time cost, whether it's a roof review or whatever, but that these are already built into the budget.
Absolutely.
Right. You said that every time. When the budget's presented, the bigger budget's presented on the additions, it has that soft cost number down there.
Right.
And then look at the total then, because you look at the hard cost number, which we're talking about two funding sources for. The funding source for the soft cost is already in your budget.
That's correct.
I just want that part.
For this initial round of work,
yep.
The schematic design, testing that we had to do, hire a construction manager, that was built into my software cluster. I have a line item under the O&M fund, which is professional fees, and we budgeted $400,000 in that line item for this work.
And when you do the projections for next year, you have a budget number in there that covers the, you know,
soft cost.
Have
the additional.
Right. So it's all in there. Maybe everybody here understood it.
Well, I think the word amendment is what gets confusing sometimes, because you think we're amending a cost, but it's already built into the budget.
For the amendment, yes.
That's right. Got it.
So we annually renew the FGM contract.
Yeah.
Yes, we do.
And is there anything over the last year that has given you any red flags to cause concern that we need to look at FGM or look at other architects of record?
No, as a matter of fact, we provided a professional services evaluation, and I'm going to say we did that in September, and we evaluated the professional services that sort of I oversee, architects, engineers, structural engineers, civil engineers, those types of services. And the finance committee saw that evaluation, and you know, I got to tell you, I've been very, very happy with the services that FGM has provided over the number of years that I've certainly associated with them. And you see them in our meetings; they're here every Tuesday. I mean, I'm on the phone with them frequently. I'm a frequent caller to their offices, or to our offices, and I have been very, very satisfied with the level of services that they have provided over the number of years that we've been associated with.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions in general? Questions for Bob? Okay, roll call, please.
Mr. Escalante?
Yes.
Mrs. Nelson?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Chinsky?
Yes.
Mr. Kenwood?
Yes.
Mr. Black?
Yes. The amendment to the Glenbard Area Property Tax Appeals Consortium to approve an amendment adding Community Consolidated School District 93 to the Glenbard Property Tax Appeals Consortium, through which participating school districts 41, 87, and 89 share certain legal costs. May I have a motion to approve the administration's recommendation as presented?
Motion. Second.
Motion by Mr. Ellis, second by Mr. Escalante. Discussion.
It's always a good thing to have an additional partner.
Well, and you know, one of the interesting things are something that's come out of the annual financial report that you'll be seeing over the next couple of months is there is a page included in that AFR that they want districts to identify shared services that you have with districts around you. And we share many different types of shared services. We share with our EBC cooperative with regards to medical insurance. We share with our CLIC cooperative for the renewal of our property and casualty. We share transportation with 89, 87, and 16. I believe Karen, you're sharing some curriculum initiatives that are underway. And this is just something else that we became involved in. It's probably in the third or fourth year now, where the work that was being done independently by essentially the same law firm, because Forensic represents a lot of the districts around here, they were just kind of duplicating their efforts. Now we have an agreement in place that, based on a pro-rata contribution of each district's tax rate, that's what your contribution is to the legal cost for a particular matter of tax appeal. And we have a number of them going on between properties along North Avenue, and I would say even more. More along North Avenue than along Roosevelt Boulevard. And then we have some other spots. The DuPage Medical Group is under appeal in Glen Allen, some apartment complexes, some small manufacturers, or just different types of local businesses. And they manage those for us. And then, as I said, their legal fees and costs are split amongst, first of all, the high school district, and then amongst the various elementary schools.
So the more districts there are, the less the fees will be.
Theoretically, that's the way we like to see it work.
The more, the better.
Any questions? Any other questions? Okay, roll call, please.
Mr. Chansky?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Nelson?
Yes.
Mr. Kenworth?
Yes.
Mr. Escalante?
Yes.
Yes. Board policy and procedures revisions. First reading and adoption. Policy committee met on October 1st, 2013 and determined that it would present its recommendation on Section 1 and miscellaneous policy revisions to the full board on October 15 for adoption. Typically, the full board would have a first reading at one meeting and a second reading and recommendation for adoption at a subsequent meeting. However, since these recommendations have been under committee review for a number of months, some are time-sensitive in nature, the committee is recommending that the board consider foregoing the first reading and adopt the policy revisions as presented. We have a motion to approve the administration's recommendation as presented.
Motion.
Second.
Motion by Mr. Ellis, second by Mrs. Nelson. Discussion.
I had a question. I need to find it here, but on the board one, board development.
Yes.
2120.
Sorry, what?
2120.
What policy is that, Chuck?
I'm trying to refine it.
And then tell us what page is the board book.
Well, it was the one on training. But how are we defining mandatory in this? We're highlighting some mandatory training.
Board member development, 2120, page 63 of the board book.
Yeah. So there were three mandatory 4 hours of leadership, Open Meetings Act, and the Performance Evaluation Reform Act.
They're mandatory because it's coming from the state. That tells us that not only our board, but all boards have to do this training.
And does the mandatory and compliance have any penalties associated with it?
For different policies, or for different training, it does. And I see Mrs. Stecker nodding her head. She's an expert on this, so
I'm sorry to hear that.
Let's ask, if you don't mind, Maureen, could you explain it to us?
The OMA?
Open Meetings Act.
Training. There are really no other than answering to your constituents.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Though.
Other than answering to your constituents for not having the training, there are no...
No penalties, no repercussions for not completing the open meeting.
According to the Illinois Association of School Boards, that the penalties for not completing the PERA and the finance and... Anyway, would be not being able to participate in votes related to those topics. So, but she did not think that it would be enforced until 2014.
That's for PERA.
That's for the three mandatory elite, the ones that it's PERA, finance. There are three different categories. I have to look them up.
Okay. Is that the one on, you know, labor law, financial oversight?
Yeah, that's number one.
Yeah.
Leadership training, education, right. Labor law, okay. Financial oversight,
also for board members elected after June 2011, where it becomes mandatory.
That particular one, yes.
That first one, number one.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I had a question on the PERA one also, and that is for us as board members I didn't get a chance to look at, or didn't take the chance time to look at the workshop scheduled for the board, but I'm assuming that there's an opportunity at the conference to do the PERA training.
Every one of these, you would have
they
an opportunity.
Because they did it the last time.
Yes.
So
it would be very true at this upcoming.
Right.
At the conference in November. But it's also available online. You can do it tonight if you want to.
Leadership.
I'm making it very easy for you.
When you get home.
I had a question, and it's probably kind of benign, but it's on page 66, number 4. I don't know if it's been in there, and I'm sure I read it when I started the board, but the board president shall have the authority to do in procedural matters regarding public participant, not otherwise defined in school policy. That seems like an absolute statement. Was there ever discussion to say the board president should have authority temporarily authority or have the decision to make procedural matters for 90 days and for until the next board discussion. I know we're not running a fiefdom here, and that Sam would never do that, but...
This is really addressing just... This is just addressing public participation, right?
But this allows the board president to set procedures unilaterally about public participation, whatever the board never have an ability to.
If it's not defined in school code,
right?
Which is very well defined in school code.
Correct.
Well, no, not defined in school board policy, in our policy.
This is it.
Under the president's responsibilities, we added language last year, I think, maybe 2 years ago, that said, I forget exactly what it read, but unless otherwise defined by the board. So we added a stopgap that said the board president has XYZ responsibilities in some ways so that there's definition around moving things forward. Right? Mm-hmm. You have to have some mechanism for that. But there is built into that part of the policy that that the board has voice in that. Yeah. I would have to go back and look and see if that was covered under.
Okay. All right.
Well, just a little background, Patrick. This policy was not changed by the committee at this meeting.
It's been in effect. That's what I said. We spent too much time on it already. If we have something underneath it.
Okay. It's a fair question because it's been brought up in other, in terms of roles and responsibilities for the officers. So,
it's just. What is the genesis of.
I'm sorry, do you want?
What is the genesis of the change?
The reason this is changed is to link and cross reference policy 830 of community relations. And I did that because the 830 speaks about. Interaction with members of the public and board members.
So what is that, the other one?
Do we have 830s in? It should be in the back.
In here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's 860.
And there was no change in 830, but I wanted it to be referenced because specifically because of number one there, which says strike, injure, threaten, harass, or intimidate a staff member. Or a board member, sports official, or coach, any other person. So my thinking was members of the public should now know and be referenced to any confrontation meeting, board meeting, public participation. This conduct is also addressed in the public participation policy. So someone were to read it and say, well, I didn't do anything that's not listed in that policy, then this is reference to that policy, which tightens that policy, makes it more effective, in my opinion. So that's why I wanted it referenced.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I knew there was a hole somewhere, and now it's closing the hole.
Okay. So, Patrick, are you comfortable with the language?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Can I have another question?
Sure.
Page 55. The $1,000. This was this was another issue that we were closing the loop on that because Paul had been approving everything, and now this is just to free up some of.
The approval process. Yes.
Right. This was modified with that in mind. And you're talking about 455. And the 455 AP was effectively rewritten by Paul to mirror the procedures that he has already been following since, not since he's been in the district, but pretty close to. Align with what his procedure would do. And that's why you see that this is all new language and the subsequent striking of the old language is not the procedure that's in place now. So we're effectively mirroring the AP to reflect the current procedure.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions?
Motion.
Okay, roll call.
Ms. Prochansky?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mrs. Nelson?
Yes.
Mr. Kenwood?
Yes.
Mr. Escalante?
Yes.
Mr. Black?
Yes. Superintendent's report.
Just briefly want to bring up for direction from the board to staff around the board meeting structure, the time. We said we would revisit it. We're starting with closed session and then moving into the regular session, generally starting around 7:30. I know at the time Finance Committee had some concerns, so we wanted to come back and make sure that we're having this conversation, ensuring that all voices are at the table. I know we've had a couple parents say it's been confusing, but I think anytime you have change around the time, you know, when does it start, when does it, when should I be here for public participation, when those pieces. But I really wanted to put it out here for board members to give me direction on how you would like to proceed with the closed session and what time you want the closed session.
Well, I like when everybody comes to the Finance Committee, like today at 6 o'clock.
Packed house.
I thought that was kind of neat. So.
It's all good.
Yeah, us finance guys enjoyed it.
Yes, you did.
Well, with all due credit, I'm going to tell you that the last couple of board meetings, we've gotten out at 10 o'clock, which is, I hadn't done this in a long, long time. So whatever you're doing, I'm kudos to you. I think we're getting out. A much more expedient method.
From Finance Committee, I know, Patrick, you had some concerns with it when I first brought it to you.
Yeah, I think we're still okay. I mean, we haven't pushed over the edge, and I think we're having our conversations. I think it's still too early to determine because we made the change, and we think we've only had one or two meetings.
I just wanted to touch base.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, we had a good full discussion, but it wasn't truly the traditional meetings that we usually have. My only recommendation is you know, I would feel for the public if, you know, if the meeting starts, if the open meeting starts at 7:30 and we're done with closed session by 7:15, maybe we just pause till 7:30 and move forward.
I think tonight showed that it can be a disruption, and that's not appropriate for the public.
The continuity of the meeting and the flow of the meeting, I think, is disrupted. But or we have the ability to flip-flop superintendent's report or board reports or something like that at the beginning until we get to 7:30 and it's a hard stop and say, okay. But
one of the other issues, John, not being able to be here, I think that's an important piece that we have to consider. Where are we at? Ensuring that all board members are able to participate at that 7:30. I want to put that on the table for us to have a conversation around.
Yeah, I look at it a little bit differently in that two reasons, personally and then I guess professionally. Personally, it would be easier for me. The later the meeting starts, the better. And that's just me, and everyone else could be different. I personally like the 7:30 meet time because of just the day-to-day, just the way my house works. You know, my wife works. She's downtown, gets home at a particular time, and instead of having a babysitter or, you know, God forbid, leave my kids home alone, the 7:30 start time versus the 7 start time, believe it or not, makes a huge difference. And procedurally, we saw it tonight when we're an hour and a half into the meeting, and then people start coming in expecting to do public participation. So, and tonight it was fortunate enough we had the time to it was a break that was appropriate that we could do right at 7:30. So you've got that piece to it, the public piece. And then the most important piece to me, I think, is that we've got a board member who says, and we have to take him at his face value, who says he cannot, literally cannot make these meetings if they start at 7 o'clock. And I would prefer if we, I like the procedure of the meeting, open the meeting, have certain things, and then go into closed session. I do prefer that. If we want to arrange it in some way where we open the meeting, have our public participation, and then go into closed session, we could do it that way if we want. But we have a board member who consistently cannot make the 7 o'clock time for whatever reason, and we have to take his word that he can't make it, that I feel that we're, you know, cutting off our nose to spite our face. Because the half hour that we may or may not be saving, we're losing, and especially if we're doing closed mm-hmm. session topics, we're losing another voice at the table. Mm-hmm. You know, whether we think it's a good idea or not, we know we're consistently, and I think that's the key, we're consistently losing that voice. If it was a, well, I can make it sometimes and sometimes I can't, I think that's maybe a different conversation. But I think that the half hour we're gaining doesn't offset the knowledge, expertise, extra voice that we're going to be losing on a consistent basis. So that I mean, that's just where I'm coming from. So I just don't think the value of the half hour start time makes up for the loss of, well, it could be John, it could be someone else. It's just in this right now, today, or this year or next year, it's John. 2 years from now, it might be someone else. So,
yeah, I mean, as the one that's most impacted, you know, I felt it was a bad recommendation and a bad experiment. It hasn't worked for me. I think, you know, I think there are a lot of people like Sam who come to the, you know, who would come to these meetings. And I think the earlier you do it, the harder you do it. And I think if you also factor in board members that may travel and may want to call in, the earlier you do it, the harder that might be if you go to the East Coast, I mean, sorry, to the West Coast. And at the end of the day, we're gaining a half hour. So, you know, Drew's point about we got out earlier, we've had two meetings, we got out earlier, I still see the staff here. Right? The purpose of it was to have the closed session, have the staff be here for what they need to be here, and then leave so they can get out of here earlier and us get out earlier, and we saved a half hour. And I don't see the benefit of that when you disenfranchise another board member.
Yeah, with all due respect, Sam, to your you know, your family situation, and I completely get that. The bigger issue for me is not having John at the table, and I know I pushed you on that to say, you know, twice a month, every time, you can't make it at 7, to the point that it's only 30 minutes. But I trust that that's the reality of your job situation, work situation, and that if you can't make it, you can't make it. So if that's consistent, then we're not, and we can't have you at the table, then I don't think that that's fair to the board to have one person out. I think getting out earlier or later, Drew, is dependent upon the topics.
Right.
I mean, last spring we had horrifically long meetings because of the issues. And we may not be feeling that right now, but they might come back. So, you know, if we could, if you know, this was put on the table, but if we could do a hybrid perhaps and start our meeting at 7:30, open the meeting, have public participation, and then go into a 15-20 minute closed session, I think what it forces us to do as a board is to really focus, listen to the closed session issue, say, yep, great, here's my questions, and move on. I have felt that closed session at the end of the meeting is just onerous, and every one of us, not the newer board members at this point, but have been responsible for the length of that closed session. So I'd like to try and do it within the context of the meeting. Then 7:30, open, public participation, go to closed, great, come back in. And then, you know, people can stay for whatever program presentation. You know, the other thing is, these are community members. If they care about this, 20 or 25 minutes, I would think, should make as that big a deal. And if we can, you know, stay within before that 8 o'clock mark, then I think we're doing service to the board, but also, you know, recognizing the needs of the public.
So, does anybody have any great objection to going back to the 7:30 start time, with the caveat that we'll open the meeting, have public participation, maybe some other menial thing, and then go right into a half hour of closed session, or what
we'll make it.
I have no objection.
I would ask that the board then leave this room. I think it's
yeah.
It sends the wrong message that we're kicking them out, and then they're trying to, especially if we have a large group, trying to fit into the conference room or wherever else. I think we should go up to 209 as opposed to kicking the public out.
And we did that before. We did that a couple cases.
Okay. I think as long as everybody's comfortable.
Yeah.
Where's
209?
Upstairs.
Can we have pizza? Can we have pizza for close time?
Regarding the finance committee, if we have a I like the hour and a half with you guys, and I know sometimes we need it. But if we're, to me, I'd rather start that at 6:30, and we just put thumbs up, so, and then we just smash in our hour. And if we have a long agenda, Bob, then we can say, hey, let's start it at 6:15, and let's start it at 6. Because we're being convenient, double schedule, I'll take a little bit of
that. The only danger, the only danger to that would be to keep changing the time. If we want to move it to 6:30, just leave it at 6:30.
And we'll report back to you if we're having problems finishing.
You want to start your finance meeting later?
At 6:30.
If we're starting this at 7:30, absolutely.
Is that fair then?
Yeah.
Do you all think you can get your work done?
Yes.
Give it a try.
You want to start at 7 in the finance meeting?
No.
6:30. It starts at 6.
Going back to where we were.
I just want to make sure we're going to 6:30.
Any problem with that? Okay, so now we're finance committee will be 6:30, board meeting will be 7:30, with the appropriate changes.
We'll make the changes.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone. I think that was a good decision.
Fill out a green card.
It's not public participation.
The next one.
Okay.
I need your direction on at the workshop that Barb Tony facilitated for us. There are a few board members who indicated their desire to have a community engagement workshop, but I would like further direction with Julie in the room. What does that look like for you? It was an interesting article today from District 200, I believe, Julie, that the board had some of the same struggles. They've reached out in a variety of ways to the community. Mm-hmm. But however they've been doing it, through coffees, through emails, through telephone calls, they've really struggled to try to have that connection. So I would just like further guidance by the board of what you're looking for. Is it a staff piece? Is it something that you're looking for the staff to do? Or is it a more of a board engagement with the community? And I'll stop there and let you guys have that conversation.
Sound like you mentioned Barb Tony as a part of that?
Barb Tony at the workshop. That's where this came from.
Oh, you're not
that suggesting? No. Okay. Not suggesting Barb facilitate any of this work. It was just a context.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I got out of the workshop and my interest from hearing us talk as a board was to have two things. Number one, a better understanding of the work that Julie does and her role in terms of being director of communications and grants is the second part of that, but and how her work informs us, and we work as a board with our superintendent and then with Julie. So that's one piece of it. The other piece is that communication plan around engagement. What District 200 board did at their last board meeting was table their approval of their Harris study, their survey that they were going to do to get go back again in terms of their the Jefferson referendum, Jefferson being a big part of it, but just their fund referendum. So they're trying to figure out, does this make sense to spend X amount of dollars? What are we trying to get at? And so for me, that was the other part of this because, Patrick, you brought up a couple times, is this time to have a community conversation around what? Clear the air and just have that face-to-face conversation. So I think it would help you and certainly help Julie if we had a conversation around what are some things that this board thinks are important around communication. Just in general, we haven't had a process conversation in a long time. I think the last time we did was when I first came on the board.
we all want to talk about that. So that's my thought.
Yeah, I guess my thoughts are to repeat the first point that Erica said. But you know, first of all, let's understand the role that Julie does, so we know how to overlay any recommendations to that. But again, I just think that we have enough information, and maybe I'm wrong. We have enough information to the parents of the environment that we directly influence, the kids' parents. But if we decide to do anything that requires votes or community engagement outside of that 30% of the community, the first time they're going to hear about it is bad news. So how, and I, ever since we started talking about it, I've been trying to figure out how do we do that? How do I find out about more information? It's that free newspaper on Saturday, the Glen Ellen News, and you know, your community comment bill, and you know, that's how I hear about some of that stuff. So I it's going to be hard, but I think we need to roll that rock.
Okay.
I agree. I mean, I think even internally, though, the people that want to be engaged are, and I don't know how we get to those. I mean, we had someone today who said that we outsource special ed. And I've always felt, and maybe I'm behind the times, but I've always felt as a district we've done more for special ed than many districts. And we've taken on a lot of special ed and been supportive of special ed. And someone here who has, I guess, a child in special ed thinks we outsource it. I know we outsource some pieces of it.
We can't house all of the programs. There's no way physically from...
So we do outsource pieces of it.
Pieces, absolutely. Right. But we're in a consortium with other districts that say, if you will take this on, we'll house this. But we're in constant communication, very much like all of the students are our students from all the different districts, and we're in this together. So I'll reach out to Mrs. Webb to see really where that frustration is and some misunderstanding, I think.
To me, it just highlights, you know, that, you know, there's a communication issue. And it's definitely, for me, it's always been the most frustrating part about being a board member is not understanding, you know, what the community is looking for. And
that should be the easiest nut to crack. I mean, we have so many tentacles to get to those parents.
Well, we use
blast and...
We use too many of them sometimes.
Yeah. So it might be that communication forum discussion.
But it is outside of our people, too. But, you know, everyone says, understand what Julie does. Understand what Julie needs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to you know, what it is she thinks she would need. I'd be interested in that perspective, and maybe she's not getting that, maybe we're not giving her that, or maybe there's, you know, more we could be doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, it's come from, you guys said this, but it's two different areas. One is it's the people we don't touch, that, you know, the 70%. And clearly, when do you do that? I mean, when you have an issue that's going to touch them is when you're going to do it. How soon should you start in the process? That's something we have to examine. I don't know the answers, but we have to talk about that. The 30%, we touch them in a lot of different ways. But when I wasn't a board member, I came in. You know, there was issues that were being presented that were new to people, yet you guys were studying them. People were studying them for 18 months. So there is something we need to get an understanding, a better way to do it, in my opinion. Being on that side for so long, and now on this side, I think we should examine it. You always want to improve, anyways.
Yeah.
So whatever you're doing, hey, let's look at it. What's the best way to go out there? I mean, we have a big initiative here for 16 classrooms. You know, and that's pretty important to this district, and I think that's something we want to make sure that we're not surprising anybody on. And then suddenly, you know, on November 11th,
So does this issue give rise to a board workshop then? Is that what we're heading toward?
I think
or?
So. I don't think we have the time to do it at a business meeting.
Is it a board issue or is it a staff issue? I mean,
I don't know that any of us have the expertise to be able to develop a communication plan. I would suggest that it's a staff function, and it would be a presentation to the board. We could take that piece and with that foundation of a framework of a communication plan, and then thrash it out as a workshop. But for us to start to have the board start from scratch, I think so it's somewhat outside of all of our purview.
Well, I agree with what you're saying, Drew, but I'm thinking about this cart and horse. My horse in front of your cart. The horse in front of that is for the board to sit down and say, what do we think are current issues, needs, things we've struggled with around communication, asking the question that John just asked, what does Julie need from us, what clarity does she potentially need as we move forward with certainly some more large initiatives. But to give a presentation to us, I think at some level we're going to be hearing a lot of what we already know and what goes on. Where I feel there's a gap right now is you know, based on how last year rolled out, there was, you know, things that we felt frustrated with as a board in terms of having to do a lot of catch-up in terms of communication. So I feel the need to talk about that and figure out how do we, from a process standpoint, address some of that. So, yes, the presentation, but first, our collaborative conversation around what are those needs. Actually, we all got this in the mail, so if I'm able to get on the webinar, I'll get the data to you, but next week there's two webinars, and one is communicating with parents in a digital environment, and then there's another one with the community in a digital environment. They're one-hour-long webinars, 22nd, 23rd, I think. That's some of what I think I struggle with on some level. We have a lot of tethered parents to their kids, and so how do we work with that? How do we recognize that? So I'm agreeing with you that I think a presentation is necessary. I think we need to be a part of the conversation on what that is.
Presentation in a workshop to maybe kick it off,
well,
and then starting to have
right,
that conversation.
Us having the conversation, yep. And Julie coming back and say, okay, what I heard you say was X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. And here's some thought around that.
I agree. I mean, I agree that we're not experts on that. I'm certainly not an expert in communication, but I think we have three new board members. I think getting out there, but we're still new. newer, getting out there and putting forth what our thoughts are. If we saw problems from when we're sitting out there, or do we see problems when we're sitting in here? Maybe we don't have the solutions, Drew, but maybe just the discussion part can then give a pathway for Julie to go down and say, okay, now I hear them loud and clear, and this is now I can get a foundation for a presentation to meet the needs of the board. That's kind of how I see it. There's probably no perfect way. But without that, Julie's going to give a presentation, and she doesn't know what Joe's thinking.
So one of the pieces that I'm hearing is really how does the staff communicate to the community? Not really the board, the engagement with the board to the community, even though you're
oh, I think that's all
that's
okay.
Part of it. Piece of it.
That's
okay, I just wanted to make sure where we were at.
Community engagement, period.
Period.
Yeah. Right.
We have a community engagement model that we went through 4 years ago, right? And then we called it the community engagement model.
Maybe that's where we started.
And maybe that's where we started.
Right, it'd be helpful to resurrect that and maybe see if we need to make any changes.
Now, we might look at that model today and say, okay, that it's outdated or it needs to be updated.
But please, well, it sounds like a workshop.
Yep, it does.
So we'll get that together. Potential dates.
You guys work too busy. How about you ask some clarifying questions? So we
didn't communicate that too well.
We'll meet tomorrow, and we'll meet tomorrow and try to figure out what we're going to pull off.
I think the there's a couple of things, right? One is to bring the newer members up to speed on, some of the communication we have. E-blasts, PTA meetings. I mean, some of the things we've launched over the years is we decided to go out to the schools, right? That was in an effort to better communicate and better engage people. So we go to the schools, get the kids involved, get the faculty involved, bring more parents to the meeting. So that's an example of something we did to try to, you know, improve communication, right? Then the e-blast started going out, and, you know, on, you know, sign up on the email, right? I mean, there's just different things we've done over the years. So we probably ought to review those things so we all understand what those are. And then try to understand from the new people, you know, what are the gaps that you see are happening, right? I mean, I'll say I think a gap is the people that are outside of our schools. I think we have a gap with communicating with them. We have certain stakeholder groups that we define, so maybe we should go through those and then determine what do we as a board want to do or improve on or try to measure in terms of communication. We have surveys that we put out. I mean, there are different things we've done over the years, but, you know, at the end of the day, when it came to Think Tank, I went to the first PTA meeting and someone said, you guys have a communication problem. So, whether it's perception or reality, it was viewed as a communication problem.
Well, I'd like another piece of this conversation to be, and spring forward to that, John, is how do we challenge the accountability of a community to show up? This is age old. When I was sitting in board meetings 10, 12 years ago, not a board member, I made a comment that a couple board members responded to, and it was, it's great that people are here when there's a big rise in the wave, but keep coming back so that you can understand the flow of the water, too. So don't just come when there's an issue. How do we, my question would be, how do we hold the interest, or how do we challenge the accountability of a community larger than a single issue? And I don't know if there's an answer to that. I don't know.
Well, I don't want to interrupt the conversation, but it sounds like we're already at our workshop talking about communications issues. So let's, I think we just said we need one. I think we need Paul, do you have anything?
I am done.
Okay. Let's move on to board reports, committee reports, or any other reports.
I just want to, can I make one news report here?
Sure.
Yeah, I saw where the Roosevelt Road TIF was approved by the village. Was it last night? I couldn't go. No. It was approved. I saw it in the papers.
It's not surprising.
Not surprising.
It looks like we had, I'm sorry, this is an administrator report. Looks like they approved a fifth TIF district over Glendale Heights, which is just west of the new Jeep dealership. So from that property over going west. It looks like that's going to be tipped out.
What is it right now?
It's vacant land now, but they probably have a building plan in place. With, you know, they had Menards over there. They have the Jeep dealership. Mm-hmm. Now there's just something else. Though I would say the probability of them tipping that entire corridor is very likely at this time.
Bob, it's a Chrysler dealership.
Jeep.
Any other
somewhere than Jeeps?
Any other reports?
I have a quick Lincoln PTA. I gave a copy of this to Maureen. Just a couple of significant things. There's Lincoln's president is Bill Enright, and then they elected a co-president, Sandy Hansen. So I'm a Lincoln PTA rep, and if that rolls over, I'll make sure that either of those gets to the next board member in terms of that. Linda Schweikofer gave a principal's report and highlighted some of their safety committee stuff, and I just want to highlight Sarah Michael, who is the chairperson for that, and a much more organized approach to drop off and pick up at Lincoln this year, which was
bad choice of words.
Sorry, more seamless kind of in and out process for the school, so that was good. Also, safe place drills planned, as well as they're doing a fire drill central lunch period, which Linda said they've never done. And so they have that plan in place so that they can be prepared should that happen. BLT, Building Leadership Team, is working on communication among teachers and parents on ISETs, the potential dip in scores, et cetera, kind of keep that on the table, which I thought was actually a very good point because we did a lot of conversation about that last year with the recommendations, and this is a good example of let's not surprise people, but keep that on the table. And then lastly, they have a student enrichment part of their budget, and assemblies this year are going to focus on a lot of science and math STEM stuff. So they're excited about that. Quickly, Paul and I attended the LEND meeting, which was the kickoff meeting. It's on September 27th. And typically they have, and they did this year again, a panel of legislators who come and either answer questions or give a brief presentation. This year, they broke it into three small group sessions and provided us kind of a summary on three key issues: the conference committee on Senate Bill 1, which is pension reform, school funding, again, coming up as another committee, the Ed Funding Advisory Committee, EFAC, being brought back and looking at how we fund education in Illinois. And then the last one was our Common Core assessments and evaluations. So we split into three small groups, and then sets of legislators kind of moved through the room. One, two key takeaways, and this came from Sandy Pihos. Board members, don't want to be heard. Call, give comments, go on our website. She said she wants to hear more from board members as that kind of elected voice of constituents in terms of schools. And also recognize that over the last couple of years, especially maybe three, education's really been under fire, and they wanted to communicate to board members and administrators that they are very supportive of education, know the work that we do, and that in a county like ours, which is sometimes they're not watching the shift that we're seeing in demographics and the needs to make sure that we keep our voices up around that when we see legislation or bills coming up that are going to strike us again. So I thought it was a really good meeting.
Is she starting to see that some of that Common Core pushback that they're in Florida and Texas? And
a little bit. In my small group, there was a superintendent that talked about that, actually a couple superintendents, and wanted to know that the state of Illinois was fully behind it. And they said, absolutely. We're here. We were part of the original group. This is it. Wanting to address some of that, because there's some disinformation out there about the Common Core, and also misinformation. And also some good challenging questions. So, there was some back and forth around that in terms of how Illinois is handling it, but the legislators that were in my small group said, this is something that we backed and that we think is important for the state, certainly, but for the country. So we're moving forward.
Anybody else? Go, Tim.
I just had a couple comments. It's a board report, but since I always like to let you guys know where I'm coming from on tonight's presentation. Just a few quick comments. Last time we talked about a Lego approach, and I do feel the plan for the new classrooms are clearly better than facilities and spaces we have today. I still feel it's a little tactical, in my opinion, in the way we're approaching this. Except for Churchill's bathrooms and the art room, I don't know that we're really addressing any of the structural shared space issues that we have at each of the buildings. And understand that's one of the cons of the approach that we're taking. We can't do everything. I feel we're still maintaining a school size of 600. And Paul, this is where I think maybe we need to look to you, because for X amount of years we've been told, 450 is the ideal, that's where you want to get to, 600 is too much, we don't have the green space to support it. So maybe that's part of the new thinking, that 600 is a good number. At some point maybe look to you on your input on that. If that is the number, then we still have the structural issues. And as an example, I felt Ben Franklin, we wrapped around the gym, and we kind of made our structural problem there last forever, because that seems to be one of the structural issues, the gym size, right? So, again, it's just some initial feelings that I had. I'm not sure I see the plan for the remaining portables outside of taking over more green space. I don't think that's an issue for Forest Glen, probably not an issue for Grand Franklin at this point if we stay at the 600, but I think Churchill and Lincoln are, I call it a strategy earlier, but I don't see another plan outside of either taking more green space or going up by tearing down a wing. So, that's just, again, from my point of view, not sure I see the plan for Hadley. And to be honest, I'm not sure where you guys are coming from anymore on from our July 15 session on whether we feel we need a new school or not. Because I feel if we do this and then we try to build a new school, we have built excess capacity possibly at the schools, and I don't know, because, you know, we're getting rid of 16 classes. That leaves us 8 more portables. So also the Spring Avenue timeline, to me, is something that that we have to understand. I mean, it's probably post-December as an option. And, Bob, I wasn't sure on the debt certificate. What's the max that we can go for? I know we had a $7 million and a $10 million. Is there a rule around what the max you can go to?
$10 million and 20-year payoffs.
Those are the max.
Two tripping points.
And those are because of our financials or because of some regulatory reasons?
Some regulatory.
Okay.
To keep it as an operating bond, it has to be under $10,000.
Okay.
They also talked about splitting the bonds over 2 years. That might give you some alternatives.
So general rule of thumb, 10 years, or $10 million, 20, $10 million, 20 years.
So you want to keep it under
that's
that.
That's for bank, so that the bank can keep them under.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And that gives you the lower rate.
Correct.
So, but that means the next calendar year you could do another 10
million. You still do some more.
So you could do 10 million more.
There's two limits. The 6.9% of your EAV is one limit. If you do that number, we're into this.
Yeah,
it's
a lot of money.
But the other limit.
6.9%, you said?
6.9% of your total EAV. We're about $80 million underneath that threshold right now.
Okay.
But you have to be able to. You have to be able to pay them.
Yeah.
So you have to.
You still have to fund that.
So then you go back to your budget, which is what Bob did in the last half, and you say, what can we afford?
Mm-hmm. And John, many of those items that you brought up were in that initial plan that I brought forward with three phases, really walking you through and the board members through how this would look long term. This is a first phase of the plan. You've got to be able to recognize the phase two and phase three, which do address Hadley, which do address a new school. I don't outline a location because I think that's still up in the air. But the plan itself, I thought, was fairly well articulated.
So I should still assume that the board members are in a pursuit of a new school.
I think if you want to right-size the buildings to get them to a level that we all believe is the right number for an elementary, I think we should. I think you have to be looking at an additional elementary school, mm-hmm. to also look down the road at full-day kindergarten, because you are adding new space. So that new space helps us with full-day kindergarten, adding those additional 2 to 3 teachers at every school. You're going to need additional space for them. So within that plan, I think staff was able to really see long-term, how do we want these buildings to be utilized for the maximum impact to student learning, and trying to ensure that our youngest children have full day and, if possible, preschool. But I can bring those pieces. That's a part of a presentation we can bring back on the 28th to see the long-term view of this plan.
And is Paul right-sizing to you? Is it 600 or is it 450? Or
for me, I mean, I've been in schools where there's 1,000 students. I've been in schools where there's 700, and I've been in schools where there's 350. All in Adamswell, all those sizes are there. It's the facility. Do you have a facility to be able to handle that many kids? Mm-hmm. And do you have the infrastructure to be able to have it? I don't have a set number. I think there's a too small is in the 300, 350 you're not utilizing. I think 1,000 is too many for elementary children. I would love to be somewhere in that 450, my optimal. I would love to be in that 450 to 550, because I think financially it's a good model, it's a sustainable model, and it's not too many kids in one location, but it's always around your, what do you have for your facility?
Right. So if you add 4 classrooms like we're proposing, and you have the constraints we have at those current schools with those 4 classrooms, what is the right size,
yep.
for that school? Is that 475? Is it 450? And we're going to find out if we have steam labs.
Well, it makes it 600.
Well,
it does it.
At Franklin and Forest.
Short term. You're right, John. You're right. Short term it does, but
at Franklin, we are enabling 600 kids in the building by putting those on.
This is a great discussion, but I'm not sure how to...
So, I mean, if anybody has a different opinion, call me up, let's meet, let's stop. And, you know. But I'm just giving you guys where I was
going. No, that's
I
good.
I think what I hear you saying, John, is that we don't want to lose sight of that there's a phase two and a phase three, phase three conversation. And that it's that we should have that in tandem with where we are with phase one. And I agree with that.
And we have a... We brought that up in an initial conversation, so I think it's important to bring it back up on the 28th
mm-hmm.
to remind, you know, as we talked about community engagement, to reinforce that with our community,
mm-hmm.
that this is a longer-term plan, and there are other stages to this plan to ensure that we have schools with the right amount of students and in the right capacity or the facility capacity.
So that would be part of the recommendation that's brought for action in November.
It wouldn't be. I mean, because that would be a referendum. There would be a lot of other conversations. I just want to show them maybe the bigger picture where this phase fits into the bigger picture.
Yeah.
That's all I would do. You wouldn't be acting on anything other than how you would use fund balance and if you would use alternative funding source.
Right. This is, we're showing this first step, the fiduciary piece of this. That
yep.
We want to be conservative, want to use funds. That was a big issue with Jefferson and pushback from the community. And that, and this is, these are these other two pieces where we're heading. And I think that is a part of the communication that needs to be constantly out there.
We use the teaching strategy whole, part, whole. We showed you the whole. We're now into our parts, and they're really important. So these parts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other reports? I just have two quick things. The policy committee is meeting again October 22nd to continue its work. The CIT met October 9th, special workshop focused on the its duty to put forth a recommendation on time pursuant to the mandate of the PIA contract. We took the Team 21 report and direction, affirmed some of it, designated for further study, other parts of it. Had a very good meeting, I thought. Mm-hmm. It was an all-day, 9 to 2-ish meeting. We came up with some very good concepts, in my personal opinion, that I think would pass board muster, but that, again, that's my opinion. And CIT has a deadline of November 19th, which is the third Thursday in November, to complete a formal recommendation to the board. CIT is meeting again this Thursday, the 17th, and hopefully to finalize that report so we don't have any other further meetings before the November 19th deadline. There are five other members of CIT in the room. Did I miss anything of any importance? Okay, good. Okay. Upcoming meetings. October 28th, 2013, Board of Education regular meeting, 7 p.m. Or are we going to change the time to 7:30? 7:30 p.m. Central Services Office. November 11th, 2013, Board of Education regular meeting, again, 7:30 p.m. Central Services Office. Other matters? Any other matters to be considered? I think John covered his. Anybody else have any other matters?
When do we start going around to the schools and having the meetings there?
There's a schedule already in place.
Is there? Okay.
Events in progress.
Yeah.
It's in.
Well, and there's a board.
No, I think Joe's not the PTA meetings, the actual board meetings.
Right.
Yeah, that's in the events in
progress. We did not schedule meetings.
This year, there's no board meetings scheduled in the schools. There has been in the past, but this year there are not any meetings scheduled in the schools.
There are none in the January. I thought there wasn't one between now and December, but there was.
I'm looking at the board
the
scheduler.
Okay.
Well, I mean, the board usually talks about doing that. There was no discussion. We met at Hadley, and there was a purpose of doing that. That was to showcase the technology, but then never made any decisions. You can certainly do that.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a set calendar. It's just a question of
is that something the board would like? Okay. We can make that happen.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we had the discussion on the value of it.
There wasn't a lot of value. I don't know. There wasn't a lot of public attendance at the meetings at the school.
They wouldn't communicate where we get the
Good luck with that.
Okay, anything, any other matters?
Any Paul, the case numbers are still pending?
They are.
Notifications and, all right.
Case and in title.
Yep.
Case more.
Okay.
We're hoping to have those numbers back by the next case board meeting. So next month, hopefully have that to you.
Anything else? A public participation. I see no one from the public is present in the room at this time, so that would be a no. There is no other reason to adjourn the closed session at this time. Okay, need a motion to adjourn the meeting.
Motion.
Second. Motion by Mr. Ellis, second by Mr. Kenwin. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion adjourned, 10:28 p.m. Thanks, everybody.